Okay. Welcome to the September 17th meeting of the Expanded Budget Committee. Just remind folks that we're going to have the presentation tonight. This is the third time we've been listening to presentations, and we will have questions, and let's try to confine our questions when we get to them to budget issues. It's going to help us make decisions about the budget. We're going to start with our largest department, our Social Services Department. Kip Gephardt is here, and all is Tom and everybody. So let's go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you. I guess we're starting the meeting tonight. I'm Kit Kephardt. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Social Services. With me tonight are Tom Herden, our Administrative Services Director, and Dina Bodner, our recently appointed Deputy Commissioner, to present the 2019 DSS budget. There we go. Perfect. So this first slide is showing the department's overall budget, and as you can see, our expenditures are increasing by about $12.5 million, and our revenues are increasing by $12.2 million. So $12 million is a lot of money. We're going to talk to you about what that's all about. Almost the entire $12.5 million is due to the Raise the Age initiative. Folks will probably have been familiar, but remember the Raise the Age legislation that goes into effect this year beginning in October improves the way that New York's justice system treats young people. 16 and 17-year-olds who have committed crimes will no longer be incarcerated with adults. And the state required us to complete a countywide Raise the Age plan. Our 2019 budget request reflects about $3.3 million in anticipated foster care, aftercare, and detention costs for Raise the Age, about $8.9 million in Anchor County state pass-throughs for the two foster care agencies, and what's not reflected here is prevention or diversion services. And we'll talk more about some late-breaking news on the foster care, aftercare, and detention later in the presentation. So our Raise the Age portion is this $12.2 million. This demonstrates that our Raise the Age expenditures of the $12.2 million will be covered by our anticipated revenues of the same amount. The Raise the Age costs and reimbursement really cancel each other out and kind of add up to no local cost, even though they're reflected in our budget. This next slide shows our recommended budget excluding Raise the Age. Our $45.5 million budget is about $287,000 increase from our 2018 budget. You can see that we're only anticipating, however, about $2,716 in revenues to cover that net local cost. So we're going to talk a little bit about what are those major influences on net local costs. This slide shows the major influences on net local cost. The green arrows show the decreases in net local costs, and the red arrows show the increases in the areas that we're showing net local cost. And we're going to talk a little bit more about each of these major influences. Oh, sorry. Our Medicaid weekly shares, although the local contributions are capped, New York State Department of Health's calculation methodology produces year-to-year changes that even out over a multi-year cycle. So for 2019, our net local costs will increase by about $242,000. But we should note that next year we'll expect to have at least an equal reduction in our share in 2020. Kind of a confusing way to calculate those, but that's the way the state does it. So lack of affordable housing increases, it has been increasing the average cost per public assistance case. What we see here is that emergency sheltering is much more costly. A housing subsidy rate for an individual when we have somebody come to us needing emergency housing assistance, that housing subsidy rate is about $400, while a bed cost in the shelter is around $72 per night. So in addition to the larger numbers of people seeking sheltering due to the lack of housing, their stay is often longer due to the difficulty in finding transitional or permanent housing for them to move into. So we've seen a change there. We're also seeing about an 8.7% decline in public assistance cases right now. Unfortunately, the impact of increasing average cost per public assistance case is being partly offset by the caseload reductions. At the end of June 2018, we had about 95 fewer recipients, comprising about 44 fewer public assistance cases compared to the same time last year. Our New York State approved increases to foster care and adoptive care providers, which the state has increased to by about 3.25%. We had only budgeted for about a 2% increase, so we're seeing a change there. And then when we looked at reduced capped reimbursement allocations, the foster care block grant was reduced by about $166,000. And then we add up our other changes to capped revenue allocations, and they come out to about $34,000 reductions. These directly increase our net cost. In the past year, we've changed our approach to paying daycare subsidies for foster care kids. Earlier this year, we identified a potential local savings if we paid for this care through dedicated daycare cases instead of doing so through the child's foster care case. And we implemented this change in April. We now estimate that it will have about an annual local savings of $115,000 as a result. So this slide really shows our full-time equivalent positions for the past 5 years. Our 2019 budget reflects a decrease in FTEs by about 4, and we've been working very hard to manage the changes that are occurring programmatically to move staff within divisions at DSS as programs change, to ensure that the work gets done efficiently, and treating staff with consideration, providing cross-training, planning staff reductions through attrition as we see programs change. So what's driving vacancies at DSS? Since this time last year, about 7.2% of our coworkers have retired from service, or sadly, we've had some pass away. We've also experienced the usual run of vacancies resulting from transfers and resignations. And in managing these vacancies, we've really tried to address several challenges. Oh, thanks. We're currently in the midst of a state takeover of administration of about a third of all Medicaid cases. We're anticipating that by April of 2019. It's been a major transition that the state has been working on for a while. We're experiencing increased workloads in emergency housing, adult protective services, and child protective services. We're implementing the county's best practice regarding information aid promotions. So let's talk a little bit more about these in detail. In our eligibility divisions, in order to avoid potential layoffs next year, as Medicaid caseloads have declined, we've done two things. We've reduced eligibility staffing overall, and we've reassigned staff from Medicaid to fill vacancies in other division areas. The second challenge consists of the increased complexity and severity of cases due to the opioid abuse crisis, housing instability, and domestic violence. To make caseload sizes more manageable and improve the timeliness and quality of our investigations and interventions, we're staffing a new CPS unit that'll include one case supervisor and four senior caseworkers. And the third challenge, we've been advised that information aides are usually promoted to level one administrative assistants as soon as they establish their eligibility via civil service exam. We've adopted this practice in this next budget, and according to our improved understanding of the intentions when this entry-level title was created. So this slide is showing the DSS titles where we're decreasing or increasing the number of positions in DSS titles. Those in red are the decrease, and those in black are the increase. Overall, the net change is four fewer FTEs. So a couple of places where we feel we've done a really good job managing all of these changes. Social services did not increase staff during the last economic downturn. And despite that, as the economy has improved and cases have changed, we've cumulatively reduced our staff by nine FTEs since 2014. Nearly half of that reduction has occurred since last year. And we're addressing programmatic and staffing challenges, trying to treat workers fairly and reducing the local tax burden where we can. The Department of Social Services has only one over-target request this year, which has been recommended in the budget. And I'm going to turn it over to Dina to tell us more.
So our over-target request is for what's called the STEP expansion. So STEP stands for Solutions to End Homelessness Program. So this is a competitive grant-funded program that combines federal and New York State funds. We've been awarded this grant funding for the past 8 years. We use these funds. We contract with Tompkins Community Action to provide rental assistance to two components, one called Rapid Rehousing and the other Prevention Program. So the Rapid Rehousing Program serves only homeless persons, literally homeless, so this means persons placed in the emergency shelter or people living in the street. So the goal is to have these funds available to quickly move people in the shelter who are on the streets into permanent housing immediately and quickly. And then the prevention services are to help persons who are facing imminent eviction to allow them to stay in their current housing or move into new permanent housing without any gap at that time. So both programs, it's structured so that in the beginning, TC Action covers all their rent, but then during subsequent quarters, the clients increase the amount of their share to the rent so that by the end of the year, they're picking up 100% of their rent. So these programs have been really successful in helping people obtain and maintain permanent housing. So over the past 2 years, households that have been discharged from the program, 83% of those who were rapidly rehoused were in permanent housing at the end of the program, and 63% of prevention. And what I'll say is in the past, prevention has been much higher for some unknown reason, which we're going to look into. It's been hard. We've lost contact with some of these folks at the end of the program. But in the past, it's been higher, like on the order of 70 or 75%. So the grant funds that we receive from the state really only cover about 75% of the service need. So to help fill this gap, we're requesting a renewal of the local funding that was approved last year to continue, particularly for the rehousing program, to move people into housing at a higher rate.
Great. Thank you, Dina. Tom's going to talk to us about a couple of things that have changed since we submitted our budget request, as well as some other factors that may impact our 2019 budget.
We received last Friday afternoon an email message from OCFS clarifying that local districts who are not operating either secure detention or specialized secure detention facilities for raise the age youths, unless you are operating a facility, you won't have any expenses if any of your kids are placed in those facilities. Instead, the state is going to cover the cost of those facilities' operations by direct payments to the parties that are operating them. So our budget request initially, that was not clear. There's quite a bit of aspects of Raise the Age that the state is working on as they go. There's still some fairly significant issues that are unresolved, even though the implementation date is about 2.5 weeks away at this point. So anyhow, this was late-breaking news for us. We haven't yet submitted updated budget figures, but we will shortly, and that will reduce that $12.2 million figure that you saw on the third slide, I believe, to something less. Another thing that has changed since we submitted our budget request was that we received three responses to our request for proposals for homeless services. Last month, we received those requests, those responses. All of the responses came in more expensively on both a gross and a net local cost basis than the contracts that we have had with our still current provider. So that was not anticipated at the time that we submitted our budget. And so as soon as we have concluded negotiations with our preferred provider, we will also be submitting to County Administration and for your consideration additional budget adjustments to our 2019 request. The Health and Human Services Committee received a briefing on that subject last week, and I believe that we will be presenting to the full legislature this Thursday evening. So we have a little bit more information about that. In addition to those things that have changed since we submitted our budget request, there are a number of issues that we're aware of that might have an impact on next year's budget, but we don't have enough information to reflect those possibilities in our budget request at this point in time, although a couple of them could be resolved before the legislature ends up passing a 2019 budget. So I'll read through this list, and then I'll go into a little bit more detail about each of them. There's presently a federal audit of Title 4E claims throughout New York State that will probably be concluded within the next month or so. I'm going to skip around just a little bit. There are some big changes happening with that federal 4E program beginning October 1st of next year, changes that were assigned the label Family First and that were part of the legislation, the federal legislation that established the current federal fiscal year budget that we're living under now. Again, current federal budget is in the final year of the legislation that concerns the SNAP, or what used to be called the food stamps program. The current law expires at the end of this month, and the federal government has not yet passed legislation either renewing it or amending it. There has the administration has been proposing, and some legislators proposing to make eligibility requirements more difficult, including increasing work requirements. I think there have been proposals to decrease benefits even for those who do qualify, and those are the suggestions that seem to have more traction. We have no way of knowing what, if anything, will be different once the federal government does in fact pass legislation either extending or revising the SNAP program. Raise the age, Kit mentioned, impacts 16 and 17-year-olds, but the state is implementing that in two phases. The part that is beginning October 1st of this year will affect only 16-year-olds. October 1st of next year, 17-year-olds will also be covered under this legislation. We are anticipating new daycare market rates, and there are some changes that have been talked about at the state's Office of Information Technology Services that we just need to sort of give you a heads up about, because they could have some consequences for local districts. So I mentioned the 4E audit that's currently underway. The federal government has identified at random, at least we're told at random, 80 foster care cases across New York State to review both the documentation concerning how eligibility was determined and then documentation regarding the authorization and for payments that were made through those cases. Even though these were supposedly randomly selected, out of 80 cases statewide, 3 cases were chosen that happened to be Tompkins County cases. The standard that the federal government will apply to this audit, this review, is that if as few as 5% of the cases, so that's 4 cases out of 80, if 4 or more cases are not perfect in every regard, the federal government may be imposing fiscal penalties on New York State for, I think they do these reviews every 2 years, so they could be imposing penalties for as long as 2 years. And most likely that would take the form of reduced federal reimbursement for either the foster care payments that we make that are reimbursed from this source or the administrative costs that we have associated with those cases. So we're keeping our fingers crossed. We believe that the cases that they chose that from our county, we think that they were in very good order. We won't know for sure what they think for another couple weeks. I think I may have gotten ahead of myself and said what I have to say about the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. That's the SNAP, also known as food stamps. And I think I did the same with Raise the Age. I apologize. So a little bit more information about the changes that are going to go into effect next October regarding the federal Title IV-E program. That program is the source of federal funding for approximately half of the foster care cases throughout the state and approximately half of our foster care cases. And the federal reimbursement rate presently, historically, has been 50% of the eligible costs. The legislation that was passed in, I believe it was January, it might have been February this year, that is called Family First, that will go into effect next year, has a couple of aspects to it. The carrot part of it is that the federal government is making it possible for states to choose to use this funding source for services that it hasn't covered in the past. They're, generally speaking, they're preventive-type services. That's good news, but there are a lot of strings attached to that possibility, and there are more onerous reporting requirements and more onerous eligibility requirements, and New York State has not yet committed to taking that carrot or not taking that carrot. So we don't know what to expect about that piece of it. The stick part of the legislation is, as you might guess from the name, the federal government wishes to emphasize placements in family settings of foster care and not to support placements in congregate foster care settings, group homes, or what are called in New York State voluntary agencies, foster care agencies. And the way that the federal government is going to make this work is that they will only pay for a child who's placed in a congregate care setting for a very, very short period of time. I believe it's 2 weeks. And if the placement lasts longer than that, there will be no federal participation in that cost from that point forward. Among the unknowns about this legislation is how New York State will respond. If the state chooses to, it could increase its funding of the foster care block grant sufficiently to cover at least half of this increased local cost, but the state has not indicated whether they're inclined to do that or not. To whatever degree the state doesn't share in the loss of federal funding, it will mean directly an increased local cost. And the quarterly amount that we receive now from this federal funding for these foster care placements is about $130,000 per quarter. Yes, our local. So I don't expect that money would disappear entirely, but that would be the upper end of what we might be looking at losing. We haven't been able to get any answers from New York State about what OCFS's, Office of Children and Family Services, understanding or expectation is about how Family First will impact the reimbursement from this federal stream for administrative costs. So we don't know if that's even potentially an additional reduction of revenue and increase in local cost or not at this time. We're in the home stretch here. So we mentioned we're expecting most likely for New York State Office of Children and Family Services to issue new daycare market rates this fall. They generally do so every 2 years. They last did so in 2016. I've not heard, at least I don't think we have heard, whether they have yet sent out to providers across the state the surveys that they do asking how much they charge persons who they care for whose daycare is not subsidized. The approach that the state uses is they send out these surveys, they group them by counties that they think are of similar size and other characteristics, and then they calculate an average, and then they set as the market rate 80% of that average. So there's no way of knowing from 1 2-year period to the next whether the new market rates will be generally higher, generally lower, or a mix. Once they come out, we'll be able to analyze, based on our current cases, whether or how much we expect they will change our daycare expenditures going forward. The last issue is we've got four bullets there. There are four different initiatives that New York State has been talking about for at least the last couple of years. That they've been talking about it a lot. It seems like they are committed to doing it, but they are not committing to any particular implementation dates. And it's been very hard to get operational information from them in terms of how certain things will work if and when they make these changes. But we wanted just to list them and give you a heads up. If or when these changes are implemented, they could have, they will have a significant impact on local Department of Social Services operations across the state. It may be, depending on which are implemented and when and how, it may be that our department, for example, might have to invest in more computing equipment than we usually do all at one time. We have a equipment replacement plan whereby we replace our computers every 5 years at present. But depending on when and how the state implements some of these changes, we might have to make a request for funding to make purchases all at once. It is also the case some of these proposed changes will change what we need from our internal IT support staff. Right now we have two persons on staff, and we have one vacancy that we are going to be looking to fill shortly. And it would change, some of them also would change our relationship and our the degree to which we rely on the county ITS department. Presently, they manage our network and they manage our telephone system accounts, but for the most part, the rest of our computing environments are supported either by local staff or state staff. But some of these changes would most likely require that we become more reliant on county ITS for support. So we don't know when these might be implemented. Hopefully they won't be all at the same time.
So thank you. That concludes our presentation. All good news, of course. Other questions?
Shauna.
Okay, I have a few questions. Can you tell me, you had mentioned in your presentation that there was an increased caseload in some of your departments. Has there also been an increase in staffing to accommodate?
So I think you're probably referring to our CPS. So the answer is no. We actually, I probably can't find it quickly, but on that slide where we look at the FTEs, we actually have reduced our, right now we're proposing to add a new CPS unit, which would add four FTEs, a supervisor, and three senior caseworkers, and we actually have a reduction of one caseworker. So we're kind of trading off due to what people do in their jobs, but no, there hasn't been an increase.
Okay. And can you tell me how many cases per caseworker we currently have for CPS?
I don't have that off the top of my head. We have provided that information recently, and I, you know what, I didn't bring that. Okay.
Okay, yeah, sure. And then I was wondering, do you have the numbers of kids that are currently in congregate care?
Again, we could probably get that information for you, but I don't have that off the top of my head. And those numbers fluctuate pretty significantly, even from week to week. So, but I can get that information.
Okay. And also how much it is per night for congregate care.
Okay, sure. Great.
Thank you.
I have the, at present, our CPS, our existing CPS units, the caseloads presently are average 16.4.
Let's go to Rich John.
I was just wondering if you could go into a little bit more detail about the raise the age expense. That's all passed through to the state and we get reimbursed. But just the scale of it is surprising to me, given it's double what we spend on our jail here. And we're at about $5.5 million for our jail. And how is this number calculated?
I think Tom can speak to that.
Yes, I can. We should have said perhaps, even absent the detention costs that we'll now be taking out, we're not actually expecting to spend that much money next year. But What we relied on in making those projections were the state's projections of how many kids our county is going to have in care when Raise the Age is fully implemented in 2 years. They provided a range of 0 to 5 kids in I think 4 or 5 different categories that when Raise the Age is fully implemented, our county might have in care. So because we had, as Kit mentioned, we had to submit a plan to the state, what we chose to do so that we weren't arguing about the assumptions, at least about the number of kids, was to take that the high end of the state's estimate and calculate by going backward if kids came into care at a steady rate over the course of those 2 years, how many kids would be in care in the first month, how many in the second month, how many in the third month. And we multiplied those by the rates that the state has provided. Raise the Age is, if the level of, if the numbers of youths are anything like what the state was estimating at the high end, Raise the Age is going to be very, very, very expensive. You're absolutely right.
Okay.
Yeah,
second question. Do you have anything in your budget for security in your lobby? Any increase there?
That's not something that we have as a proposal. I think that's something that I think I would want to discuss with Jason. And I think because security is something that is talked about by departments kind of countywide, I would maybe want to have that conversation broader.
Good. Thank you.
Deborah Dawson.
Thank you. So I had a question about your over-target request for the STEP program. It seems like you've got kind of a structural shortfall in terms of grants. You're falling short for 2 years in a row, 25% of the cost, and that comes out to $42,000, which was a one-time last year and a one-time for the coming year. I mean, is this really a one-time request, or is this something that's going to be baked in going forward?
What I can say is that we're in the last year of a 5-year grant cycle. So in this coming year, we'll be applying once again for additional funds. My hope is that given the high need that we have, that we'll be able to draw down more money from the state. But it'll depend on a lot of things. So,
Anna Kellis.
Deborah asked my first question, so thank you. That was helpful. My second question is on the homeless service contract. I thought I recalled the estimate was $300,000, not $200,000.
You're right. I saw that after we had sent our budget presentation over this morning. The least expensive of the proposals was going to be about $200,000 more. Our preferred provider is about $300,000 more.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Tease
everybody with that.
So it's 300 and not 200.
Can I ask one addition?
I just want a clarification. Is it 300 and not 200?
That's right.
Okay. Go ahead.
So with a follow-up to Deborah's question, is the interest or the intention to reevaluate at the end of this 5-year contract the total estimate, and then that may be readjusted for the next 5-year contract?
So so it's a grant application. So we're at the end of the 5-year cycle. So we'll apply again in the summer for another 5-year cycle. We'll certainly request and justify a larger amount. What I can't guarantee is what the award will be.
This is the award that we've gotten consistently for the last 8 years.
We've always.
Is it very competitive, and is it all county DSS departments that apply for it? Who are the applicants?
So it is. It's gotten more competitive over the years. That's part of why our allocation has dropped some, because the pie is being split up a little bit more. But hopefully, I think there's, with additional money from the state and the governor's sort of initiatives, there might be more availability. The applicants vary from county to county, so we're seen by OTDA as kind of a model county for our DSS partnering with not-for-profit agencies and other counties. The applicant might be a housing program or multiple housing programs in a county.
So one last follow-up to that. Have you heard anything from the second floor about an interest by the governor to increase the funding to this pot, or is that something that would
need to? So in a couple of weeks, there's actually going to be an OTD housing forum, and so I think that's kind of where we get our on-the-ground information from the state, so hopefully.
You'll let us know.
Yes.
Martha Robertson.
I want to ask about the state takeover of the administration of Medicaid. So they intend to take over a third of all the cases by next April. Is this going to track through and another third the following year, another third the following?
No, the primary takeover is happening within that time frame. We're in the midst of it right now. Each month they pull some cases. We've also it's a bit of a tricky process in terms of how things are going, because there are some cases that are returned to us at the local district, so it's a bit unpredictable in terms of how it's going, but they are steadily taking cases. There will always be a Medicaid program administered at the local level on a much smaller scale. There are some cases that really require administration at the local level, and we will continue to serve those folks in that way. Do you want to add anything to that, Tom?
The cases they're taking over are the very simplest cases.
Right. So the intention is to reduce the local work, and so that's where you get to that slide where you talk about how you've moved people around, right?
Right.
That's the idea.
We've been actively doing that, proactively doing that, I should say. We really have looked every time we begin to see the work go, we have really looked at streamlining. One of the things that we've done for the last couple of years is when we have places where we potentially could have hired, we've really tried to hold off and maximize everything that we're doing efficiently to then move somebody into where there still is work, or sometimes there has been emerging work in another division, and then we move people into those places. So
at the end of this process, like how many, any sense of what percentage of the cases we'll keep and they'll take?
I don't know. That one's a really tough one. I get asked that question a lot, and I think with other districts, other DSSs that have gone through this process, they really have also not been able to predict both beforehand and as they've gone through it exactly how many cases. A Medicaid case is not a Medicaid case. There are very different components to them, and so it's very difficult to look within the categories of Medicaid cases to know which ones are going to stay with us and for what reasons.
Well, I've got one more question, but I appreciate your effort to find places for people so we're not, that we're actually using the people that we have in our system and not just laying people off. So thank you. On the child care, daycare subsidies, I don't know if this, I'll make this a question, but they find out what the average is, and then they pay us 80% of that, and that's a good idea? Question mark? That's a question.
The methodology has never made sense to me.
Okay. Right, that's the answer. All right, thank you very much.
We appreciate it, everyone, for coming in tonight. A difficult number of challenges ahead. We can see that in a big department, and we appreciate your efforts. Thank you, Dina. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Kit.
Thank you.
Well, we're now 17 minutes over. Just to let everyone know that.
Thank you for the invite. Yeah, wonderful.
Our next department is the sheriff's office and the jail. This is in section 4, page 230 of your book. There are two over-target requests, number 52 and number 69, both of which have been recommended by the county administrator. And we have Sheriff Lansing, welcome, Undersheriff Robinson, and Jail Administrator Ray Bunce.
Thank you.
When you're ready.
Okay. All right, go for it. Okay, this is our recommended budget for the road. The expenditure changes are attributed to SRO as an over-target request. The white-collar contract wage settlement that was done is reflected here. And some fringe savings and just general wage growth. In the civil, there's been an increase in what we call free paper services. It means just that we're serving papers, which takes up a lot of time, and we're not getting paid for it. And unfortunately, there's been a decrease in the paid paper services, such as income executions and some of this. So quite a swap around as far as getting any money in. There's also been an increase in pistol permit applications due to, obviously, the SAFE Act and also the recertification, which the New York State Police put in, that comes around every 5 years now for people to contact them about the pistols that they own on their pistol permits, even though we hold the pistol permits here in the county. And the road patrol, unfortunately, some of the problems we've had is staff absentees, and that's obviously, we've had quite a problem with 207Cs recently, some worker comp cases, and also some administrative leave. Yes, we did get some back. I think at one time we were 8 out from the roadside, which really puts a damper on our ability to do what we'd like to do. Yeah, obviously the overtime influences the budget, as we all know. Again, that has contributed to the absentees and the extra details which we provide for the community for various things that we partake in during the year. The Kendall project would be one that I would say was very costly and something that we just have to do every year in May. For the IC students. The use of our part-time deputies at the airport, which has influenced the revenue coming back from the airport, but it will also influence over timelines and salary lines. So it's a kind of a give and take with the part-timers, and we haven't had them long enough to really start to see the benefit that's going to give us, but it's going well. One of the other things that we have now is a SINT line, and this was created to separate the function for the unit so that we can track and monitor the use of the funds and be able to analyze the use of those funds at the end of the year. So that's why this new line came up. It's been funded before, but we just changed it to read as a SINT.
Incident.
Yeah, critical incident team, yes, negotiating team.
It encompasses SINT and SWAT.
Right.
And as you recall, last year the city had a request for $12,000. It was actually a multi-year request. And instead of giving the money to the city, you folks voted to allocate that money to our budget, and this is simply so that we can track that money within that unit.
Okay. I'm going to turn it over to the undersheriff for this next presentation.
Full-time equivalents will go up. That's all part of the OTR that we're going to want to discuss with you. This OTR was supported in the county administrator's budget, and I think it's no secret as to what it is. If you don't mind, I would just soon save this one for last, because I think there's going to be some discussion about it. And we have some guests here as well. And we'll try to get through the rest of this fairly quickly, and then I'll try to get back. So I guess we're saving all questions to the end. We do have the corrections part of the budget. Expenditures are up. Contractual is all that is. Other than that, it's pretty much status quo budget. There are some longevities and just normal wage growth in there, and that's what's reflected there. As far as the major influences, for the past several years, in fact, Corrections has been able to operate within its budget. As we know, a lot of what's in the Corrections budget is tantamount to a guess, and we do our best to try to hit that moving target. And I think the legislature is wise enough to adequately fund it, knowing that if any money is left over, it's not subject to rollover or anything. It goes directly back to you. And for several years now, there's been a surplus that has actually gone back to the county. Medical and board outs, again, unpredictable. I believe administration, along with Dave, I think is involved with the analysis as well.
Kevin.
And Dave.
Kevin and Dave, yes, I'm sorry. But the board outs, basically. Yeah. Yep.
It's somewhat of a guess. And I know last year, given the situation with the COC and giving up the variances and so forth, it was a real guess. None of us knew. We kept the funding within our budget that we normally did, and there was also some placeholder money set aside by the legislature. I can tell you that this has worked out very, very well this year. And again, it might be lucky. I would suggest that you continue to keep the placeholder in. But right now, or actually as of September 1st, because we get reports every month and there's some target dates that we always look at to see how we're doing throughout the year. And September is one of those dates, which is two-thirds of the year. So you're looking at all your lines for 0.667. And board outs this year are at like 37% of our budget. So I guess that's a tribute to everyone from our guys to the courts to ATI programs, everyone. I think we were really looking to get stung quite badly with the loss of beds through giving up the variances, and I think everybody has pitched right in. And right now, today, we're not seeing that, but that doesn't mean that it will always be that way. But we're in pretty good shape as far as medical. Again, we've been lucky. Medical costs are okay, but the numbers that you see within our budget are part of a four-year analysis, and it has taken in spikes and low times, and I think what's in there is a realistic number. And I just came to that. The full-time equivalent is a change of two. This is a change of two from last year's budgets. They were both done by resolution earlier this year. A transfer from mental health for a counselor that has been working there since the beginning of the year, but the funds just transferred from mental health to our budget. And also the addition of another full-time nurse, which is actually working out very well. I'm going to let Ray speak to the one over-target request that we have in the corrections, if he can read it.
You guys can read it. I can just talk about it, I guess. this is the... the reason for this thing is all the information kept in the jail is kept on a computer program. And as you know, you have to purchase licenses for these things in order to use them, utilize them. Over the years, we've utilized or been able to get by with only four licenses. We have an upgrade to this entire system, which would probably be better described by Greg Potter than me. I don't see him here, but... this is just moving things to virtual servers and the way it's explained to me. But in doing so, I estimated, and it's probably a conservative estimate, that I needed two more licenses in order to continue the operation the way we do it right now. We were able to purchase those licenses this year using some equipment money. Purchase a license. This amount here is strictly for the ongoing annual support for those licenses. So, and that's all that is.
Any questions for Ray before we get into the other?
Martha Robertson.
Hello, everybody. I'm looking at page 238. For section four, the bottom of the page, medical and boarding. So it says mandate inmate boarding, and the number is 141,582. So is that the total that we have set aside for board outs?
Yes. In our budget. In the sheriff's office budget.
Is there more somewhere else, like a contingent fund or something?
Yeah. We have a...
Jason?
We have a...
Your tonsils look good.
Yeah. There is a one-time, it's a continuation from last year, a one-time OTR for $300,000. It is a separate line in the contingency budget, so it's not part of your base contingency budget. But it's the same set aside that was put there from last for the current year. They're being proposed for 2019. And then I think what we talked about with the sheriff is see how this year goes and then make a determination if it's recommended for next year and see how things pan out. So yes, there is a one-time contingency, one-time addition to the contingent budget for board outs.
Okay. So Brian, you said we're about 37%.
Yeah, I'm looking for
it. So if we went continued to go at this rate, like what would the total be for the year?
Give me a second to find it.
Probably less than half of it.
Less than half of the 141?
Probably close to 70,000 if you're at 30 some odd right now.
No, he said 37%. He didn't say 37,000.
We have 141,582. Is that what's on there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is the combined report as of 9/5 of this year. And year to date, we have 52,055. We have a balance of 89,526 with no encumbrances, which means we don't. We don't have anything out there. And it gives you a year-to-date percent, which is 37.
Okay.
You know, that's not to say that's what it's going to be next year. You know, these numbers don't lie. That's what it is this year. Again, I'll just say it's a tribute, I think, to everyone that that's where it's at. And of course, that's a judgment call on your part, what you would like to have in reserve above and beyond this. I'm just telling you what the numbers are.
Okay, I mean that's just amazing. And I'm looking at the same page. I'm looking at overtime towards the top of the page there. $252,000. It looks like it's been pretty consistent for 2016, 2017, and 2018. I mean, is that about what we spend, or do we dip into something else somewhere? Does it end up being about that number?
I'm gonna try to find the year to date for that. You know where it is on these reports? Oh. Yeah. Can you explain that?
All right, so somebody can know that I'll get around to asking this for the roadside, too, at some point. So go ahead.
So the report that Brian's got in front of him shows multiple overtime lines, and it doesn't provide an aggregated number, but we can get that for you. The in their budget, there are a series of each position or each line has its own overtime line. Doesn't roll it up in a way that's easy to put a finger on here, but we can look at that.
Okay, that'd be great. Thank you.
You bet.
Anna Kellis.
Martha actually hit on the two questions that I had. I'm just going to ask a little further questions to those. I've been watching you over time, and I'm wondering if it is so consistent, why we aren't putting that into the base target. Or it is. Am I not understanding that? It's just a budget line. So it's always in the base budget and we just earmark it? Okay. So I'm used to seeing overtime as something that we allocate and we put in contingent, but this is part of the base budget. So that was my own misunderstanding. And then with the mandated, the inmate boarding, 37% is about $52,000. That's about what we have spent so far this year, if I understand correctly. But we set $300,000 extra aside in contingent in case. Is that correct? And so, Jason, are you recommending that we do that again this year, even though we've only used 37% of this?
So you've used the 37% of your budgeted amount.
The 141.
Which is 141. And in addition, we recommended that we keep the OTR in place for $300,000 for the unknown amount of board outs that could or could not arise. So I am recommending we continue that, yes.
So for one more year, that's what you were saying, one more year.
For 2019, yep.
And is that partly because we don't know what's going to happen with Raise the Age? Is that what you were thinking? Or is it just because you still feel this is somewhat volatile?
Because I think it's volatile. I think while we're doing well now, and I agree with the undersheriff, I think less than 1 year, I mean, you've literally had 9 months of experience without the variance. So I think you owe to yourself at least 2 more years of evaluation before you make a permanent decision.
Shauna Black.
Hi there. I was wondering, can you tell me why the overtime for the sheriff's office under law enforcement is so high?
Can you repeat the question?
Well, it's been pretty consistent, as you can see. With the overtime, you know, it's difficult to, you know, like I just said, we had eight people out. You know, that's almost three per shift on disabilities or whatever. And, you know, it's just not something you can predict. So, you know, we deal with it. You can't very well tell people we're not going to put cars out on the street if we don't have enough people to work. So that's where the overtime comes. We do get reimbursed with some of the big overtimes, especially like grassroots. And but one of them that we don't is the Kendall project every year that we have overtime for up in Ithaca College area. So, you know, so those there, you know, you can't very well not take care of those either. So.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I was trying to understand what project it is that you said you don't get reimbursed for.
The Kendall, up on Kendall Ave every year, the college kids have a huge party. And all right, and we pretty much go up there and monitor it and make sure that there's no issues and problems. And it's been working out very well for the last three or four years. But it's a bill that the county you know, takes in and but like grassroots, we get paid for that. Right. Football games, we get paid for that we would do at high schools and things like that at the high school.
So it wasn't my original question, but thank you for bringing it up. So I do have a quick follow-up. So grassroots, I understand, and you know, there was years back when many of us were involved in trying to negotiating, you know, detail on a contract and all of that. So you're saying this does not happen with the college Kendall project?
That's correct. It's not a matter that we haven't tried. I've tried several times. I go to the community meetings that they have once a month, and it has been suggested before, and it's fallen on deaf ears every time.
So what happens if you don't provide detail?
We'd have a mess up there, to be honest with you. It would be out of control. And even just the idea of keeping it under control is not the only issue. You have a lot of people up there that get highly intoxicated, and we're there to help the ambulance. Bangs puts people on the scene. I would never want to leave them up there in that area without some kind of police protection. And I'll be honest with you, over the last 3 years, the students have gotten used to us being there, and we have a good rapport with them, so it's preventive maintenance, I guess, is how I describe it.
Much appreciate the explanation. I didn't know about that, so thank you. My question actually is for Jason. I want to follow up on the over target, the contingency fund for potential board outs. This is just, I want to make sure I'm getting this right. It is sitting in legislature contingency in the event that we need it. It is not something that's appearing in the department budget.
Correct.
Is that correct?
If you went to the contingent budget, you would see two lines. One is $900,000, which is your contingent fund base.
Right.
The other $300,000 is a one-time, the continuation of the one-time OTR for board outs.
We didn't touch.
So it is under the contingent fund. Should you exceed the $141,000
right.
in the budget amount?
Right. Thank you.
Just another point of clarification. That one-time OTR does not impact your tax levy because it is one-time right now.
Right by mine. Thank you.
Martha, then I'm going to ask a question.
This Kendall party, is this once a year or how often or what is that? It's the end of the school year?
Yes. It's... It's basically IC's slope day.
Okay.
It's the day after classes.
Fountain Day.
Yeah. The unfortunate part is that it's held on a Saturday, and it's held actually off campus in a neighborhood. Kendall Ave, Pennsylvania Ave, and after years of complaints, which rightfully so, from neighbors, residents, in that area, we decided we've got to put a thumb on this.
Okay, so do we do anything for Slope Day at Cornell?
No.
Okay.
That's in the city, and Cornell handles it.
Okay, so your overtime is, you know, $416,000. I'm pretty sure that's not from a Saturday in May.
I don't know where you're getting at.
Well, that's page 230. Okay. I mean, I'm just saying. So I understand Ithaca College maybe ought to be asked to put a little money into the sheriff's office for that, but...
They have been.
Okay. So, but that's clearly not the majority of your overtime budget.
No.
Okay.
No. Again, overtime is part of our budget, and with these reports that we get, it's you know, you're tracking it, and I look closely at it at the 6 month mark. You know, it should be when you go all the way to the right and you're looking at year to date, it should be 50 for a total functional unit. That takes in wages, that takes in everything, overtime, all of it. I looked at it last week, and for the civil, their personal services line total is at 66%. It's supposed to be at 66, 67.
By civil, you mean the road? Or
no.
That's
the way these things come. The road, personal services, 0.67.
Okay.
It's right where we should be.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I have a more global question having to do with overtime. Ken, could you remind me what we pay an elected sheriff now?
What we paid what?
Your position.
What you pay me?
I'm sorry?
My salary?
Yeah.
I don't get overtime.
No, I know you don't.
Yeah.
But I wonder what...
Just so you know. And I do put in more than 40 hours a week. But anyway, I don't know what my salary is. I don't pay any attention. I think it's 90-something, 95, 96, right. Somewhere around there,
really,
honestly.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying anything about your salary, except I wanted to compare it. We recently saw an article talking about the highest paid people in our county, and a particular deputy was mentioned as making $145,000, which I assume is greatly influenced by overtime. And I'm wondering why a particular deputy would get that much overtime.
It was an investigator.
How is it spread out? And doesn't that affect the cost of our pensions in the long run? And how do you basically try to manage that?
That made for good fodder, if you will. That particular person had about $30,000 in retroactive pay paid back to him for like 7 years of no contract. And he is an investigator, and they do work a bit of overtime. They get called in the middle of the night, so they do get overtime. Wherever the source of that figure came from, they're certainly not going to delve into the weeds and find out where it came from. And I'm just telling you where it came from. $30,000 of which was retroactive. So
the point about managing the overtime for these higher paid deputies, how do we do that?
Well, we have a contract, okay, and so like I said earlier, I can't very well tell the public because we're short bodies that we're not going to put out cars to protect them. That's our job to make sure they are. I guess the only other thing I can say, sir, is that we have been in the black since I've been the sheriff in the jail and pretty much on the roadside, too. So I think that's the whole thing, managing the budget completely and totally and still respecting our community people and making sure they're safe and that we're doing the job they need to do to keep them safe. So that's how we look at it, and that's how we do our best. And I surely can't control how many people are injured.
But at what point do you decide when to ask for another deputy who might cover this?
Well, every year that I've been sheriff, sir, I've been told not to ask for anything extra, and we haven't.
Who's told you that?
this legislative body. Okay, we've been told we cannot go. We have to stay within the, you know, our budget, and you're not going to stay in your budget if you're putting extra bodies out there. In fact, at one point in time, when we promoted Captain Bunce, we were able to get a corrections officer out of that because we didn't fill the lieutenant spot. So that's how we creatively decided to do it without coming to you and asking for more money like we were told.
All right, I'm going to go to Deborah Dawson.
So the newspaper didn't want to go into the weeds on this one, but I do. So this person that they mentioned was reported as getting paid $145,000 in 1 year. What's the base salary for an investigator?
88, I believe.
Okay, so that means that, okay, so 88 plus 30, you said, was... The
I'm guessing it was 30. A lot of them were 30, and he's a veteran guy, so I'm guessing that's what it was.
So that still leaves like $30,000 in overtime, which is a hefty chunk of an $88,000 salary. And this was an investigator, not a road patrol person. So I'm having a hard time understanding why we have a system and a staffing level that produces that kind of high ratio of overtime. And I'd be real curious to know, across the board, does this high percentage of overtime occur often with your employees? And perhaps we ought to be revisiting your staffing levels, because this carries over into their pensions and their, you know, I just think it's costing us a lot of money, more than maybe an additional staff person at an entry level.
Well, as I stated earlier, that's one of the reasons that we negotiated part-timers on the road and in the jail. We haven't had them long enough to start to really see the substantial savings, but I can tell you at the airport that used to cause a lot of overtime also because of the hours and things and when we didn't have somebody there. Now that we have part-timers, we're saving money. So it's going to take time. We just negotiated that contract, and the part-timers will. I know that for a fact because I experienced it in a smaller department, obviously, at Cougar Heights with part-timers. So these things will come.
Jason, did you want to comment?
Just in general about public safety overtime. Sheriff, is there minimum staffing provisions in the collective bargaining agreement?
Yes, we do, and that's what I alluded to when I said that. We guarantee that there'll be 3 road deputies on and at least 1 supervisor in every shift.
So generally speaking, you know, in a public safety budget, whether it's police or fire, when you have minimum staffing provisions, things that run up and generate overtime or have built-in overtime into the budget are things like leave requests then add up. So when you have a certain amount of folks out on leave, whether it's vacation, personal leave, comp time, or injury, that then starts to press on that platoon or that unit to meet minimum staffing. So if you have to have a minimum staffing of 3 or 4 on the road, depending on how many people are out at a certain time, may require overtime to fill that minimum requirement. The other thing that generally, when you speak about overtime, and this goes across the board with any department. So, for example, if I take highway as another example that is a department that has overtime, it's generally there's a cost effectiveness for overtime to be in the budget versus hiring new staff, because, in general, when you hire additional body, not only do you have the salary, but you also have the benefits, the fringe benefits, which is anywhere between 40% to 50% in addition. So most budgets like this that run round-the-clock operations, highway would be an example. Police, fire is another one that has another type of round-the-clock operation. It's very typical that you're going to have built-in overtime because at the end of the day, if you were to totally staff without overtime, you would be overstaffing on a lot of the time frames because you would want to you wouldn't want to have any overtime. So you'd be overstaffing most times to cover all instances or all possible scenarios. So that's just a little bit of understanding from a public safety, you know, and general overtime perspective, because we deal with similar issues with highway, particularly in winter events, and we deal with similar issues at the airport as well, because fire, you know, the crash fire rescue group runs 20 hours out of 24. So it's a common underlying. I think the bigger challenge, and I've spoken with both the undersheriff and sheriff about this, some of the challenges that they face is the unpredictability of injuries.
It's a very aggressive sport you're in, and sometimes we've talked plenty of times even with Ray, 207C cases, which are challenging to get folks back or injured in the line of duty. And if you have a few of those spike up, it's going to impact your overtime negatively.
Okay. But we can certainly get those figures for you if you want to know the overtime for each individual. We can get it. As far as a manager of the budget, again, I go back to the reports I get from personnel and finance. And I guess I will say again, in looking at the combined report, and again, it breaks it down between functional units. So in the law enforcement unit, personal services, which is pay, is running at 6.67, which is where it should be. And the total functional unit is also 0.67, which is where we're supposed to be.
Okay, let me tell you where we are. Thank you for that,
yep.
Brian.
Yep.
I've got 2, 4, 6, 7 of you who wants to speak. We want to give them an opportunity to get into their other OTR, which they have guests here for. So I'm going to ask folks that are talking to please make your questions brief to see if we can get brief answers. I have Leslin, Mike, Rich, Martha, Glenn, Henry, Glenn, and Anna.
Mr. Chair,
Ann Corman, sorry.
Thank you. Jason, quite eloquently and better than I would do, offered the explanation I was about to offer to help understand some of the overtime issues. I don't just hear it from our own sheriffs. Most law enforcement faces we hear it from about what's going on. And if people are out and others don't want to work, it might be that one person who is willing to work all the time so you can meet those ratios. And unfortunately, it does look a little bit skewed. I've been down this road several times with a few people, so that's just one scenario. There could be several others and other factors as well.
I don't want to belabor the point that Leslin and Jason made, but I do want to just clarify the numbers a little bit. So you have 48.4 employees, but 8 of those people are out on disability. So basically, to keep the services that we have right now, you would kind of need to hire 8 more people. Because 40 people are doing the work of 48, is kind of what you were saying. Is that correct?
Yeah. And you take 8, you got 3 shifts, that's almost 3 a shift, one more. So that you're missing. Correct.
Well, we're looking at corrections. I think everyone's pretty much talking about law enforcement.
But right, so how many are out?
Yeah, it's roughly the same, but. Okay. I don't know if I can figure out how to get back to her. and that is cyclical, the leave. I mean, we do have a few that have returned since then. But, you know, as far as overtime, I think Ken hit it. You know, you're responsible to the public for a certain number of people, and we will do it, even if it means we have to come to you for more money, which we haven't, but, you know, we would if we had to, because, let's face it, that's who we work for, is the public. As a manager, you want to make sure that your overtime, insofar as you can, is event-driven and not schedule-driven. And when an event comes up, I mean, if somebody calls us for help, we're going. I can't put it more simply than that.
Rich John.
Go ahead.
Good.
Are you passing?
Yes.
Martha Robertson.
Yeah, I'm Rich. Brian, I know you're saying you're at 67% of budget, but that's according to the budget. So it is but the budget here is, 2017 actual was 361,000. 2018 modified budget 416,000. So I mean, I think this bears more scrutiny. I'm not interested personally in individual lines, individual people. I do think perhaps public safety ought to have a chance to look at some history over a few years. And I think we have had the part-time capacity for a couple of years now, and it was really sold as it's going to help us with overtime. So I'd really like to see that pushed some. And yeah, we understand you definitely need a buffer. There's no question. But I think it deserves a tougher look. Thank you.
Henry Granison.
Yes, I also thought that with the board outs that you use overtime people to board people out. And since the board outs are lower, wouldn't that make the overtime lower?
That's a different unit, but go ahead.
Just to talk about that a little bit, yes, overtime is involved on that. It also comes into play, just like if they have an emergency, somebody needs help, they're going. In the jail, it's a little bit different. We have a constant watch that might come up that's not scheduled. We have transports that come up that are not scheduled. Hospital stays that are not scheduled. That's kind of the driving force in our budget for those things. And we did bring in part-timers this year, just this year. We still do not have all those part-time positions filled, and we will still, I think that'll make a difference, just not that we've seen at this point. So.
And as just one quick point of clarification, yes, we had part-time people approved in our labor agreement, but it wasn't until last fall that we actually had money in the budget to pay those part-time people. So that just got started earlier this year.
Glenn Morey.
I'd just like to hear about the school resource officer.
Can we move forward? We'll get to that. Let me just get Ann, and then we'll move to that. Ann Corman.
Maybe the information is in here, and I can't see it. How many vacancies are there right now in either department? I heard an ad on the radio.
That's for corrections. Entry level list, the creation of a list test.
I have one part time vacancy. One.
Yep.
Ken or Brian, go ahead with your other OTR that you want to talk about.
Sure. We are asking for an OTR of $24,093. That represents a quarter or 25% of an FTE, funds for an FTE. For a SRO at the BOCES campus. Just as a bit of history, some of you have already heard this, but for the benefit of everyone, we were approached last fall from folks from BOCES looking to partner with us for a school resource officer on their campus. A lot of discussions took place. Some national events took place in amongst all of that, let's be frank. But through it all, they want to still have that. We've had meetings with them. This was actually going to come through the committee cycle earlier this year in the form of a resolution. I think the county administrator smartly suggested that we hold off and make this part of the actual budget for next year. So I guess I can't do it justice as to why they feel they want one, although we certainly agree. And at the suggestion of the county administrator, quite frankly, and I think it's a good one, We respectfully ask that you hear from BOCES themselves as to why. Dr. Mattis is here, the superintendent, and I know he would like to speak with everyone, so if that's allowable.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Jeff Madison.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this evening. I have with me tonight our board president, Kathy Zoller, and our director of exceptional ed, David Barr. So about a year ago, we had several of our administrators come to me and just describe the present model we have used to dealing with situations on our campus that get beyond the capabilities of our educational professionals. So first you need to understand our campus and what we do. We're a service organization. We're not a standalone school. We don't get direct aid from the state. We are a tuition-based service to our component districts and to districts around the state for various services. Probably the things that are most known for at a school like a BOCES is our special education services that range from medically fragile students, mostly disabled students, learning disabled students, mostly disturbed students. But we also have a large therapeutic day treatment program on our campus. We also have over 100 student regional alternative school on our campus for students where their homeschool situation is not working out for them, some for disciplinary reasons, some for it's just not the right fit, and they need a smaller school environment to be successful. And we have just under 500 students in our vocational educational program. So we have around 900 and some odd students every day coming to our campus. We probably come in contact with 30% of all the 11th and 12th graders on our campus at some point during the school year, and 8 to 9% of all students in our region are educated, at least in part, by TSD BOCES. So in the course of events on our campus, we have some students with very challenging behaviors at times, which is the reason they're in our therapeutic day treatment program and in our alternative programs. We are the provider of many mental health professionals to our component districts, including school social workers. In our therapeutic day treatment, we have full wraparound services with our partner, the Racker Center, who are housed on our campus. We have crisis intervention teams that are there to respond immediately to all events in our therapeutic day treatment programs and also assist in our other programs. Even with all the mental health professionals we have, and we certainly add them as we see the need to them, since we are the provider of them and do a lot of hiring of those folks, even for the sharing between our districts. There are events that get beyond the ability of our mental health professionals and our educational professionals to de-escalate. Also, when you have 350 employees, 900 students coming to your campus every day on and off, there are other kind of events that happen on a campus setting. We're also in the town, and we have uninvited visitors on occasion. We have tight parking, and we have vehicles sometimes get to know each other a little bit closer than they need to. So those result in various calls to the department to come to our campus. The place we're most concerned about is obviously our student program, because what ends up happening is we are bringing a person off of community policing onto our campus, not knowing what they're coming into, and we have to fully brief them on the student, on the program, on the occurrence that's happening before they interact with our student. Then, after the event is handled, many times it's a high-stakes interaction between law enforcement and the student. Our law enforcement professionals leave our campus, do their part, and then we debrief on how to get better in dealing with that student. And during that debrief, guess who's not there? One of the people who had a high-stakes interaction with the student. We're looking at trying to find someone to be part of our team. We're not looking at trying to harden our district. We're not looking to criminalize student behavior. We already have students who have interacted with law enforcement at various levels, but we have students on our campus, and we've developed a lot of expertise in this, that we can take them over a period of years and not only begin to help change their behavior so they can go and interact with society in a more positive manner, but since we're an educational institution, they receive their education, and many leave us with a reading diploma when they're otherwise not on that track without our intervention. So we're looking to have someone be on that team who is there every day, can form the relationships with the students, be there as part of the crisis intervention team, not as someone who's coming in cold. Because one of the things that happens is a different person every time. Not the fault of the sheriff's department, right? It's the first call. It's the closest person. They come. They do their job. They're professional. They interact with our students at the highest level they possibly can. And then they're gone. We want someone who's part of our community to be part of that. We have a robust health and safety service on our campus. We develop a lot of expertise in that. We have a lot of passive safety situations on our campus to protect the campus and to protect our students. And we are the service provider of health and safety to all of our component districts, many component districts outside of our TST BOCES, and we have 47 people who are right now contracting with us with our Navigate Prepared program, which is a software program through a vendor that we've partnered with that allows early response to all district campuses, also has scenarios built in for training for all school personnel, which we do ourselves as well. And it has an operational feature that easily tracks students and allows by one button for any one of our personnel to declare a lockdown to protect the entire campus, and allows by one button being pushed at the 911 center to allow law enforcement access to immediate access to all of our cameras to protect our campus. So we believe that we have a lot of great ideas for keeping our campus safe. This one is about making us better at what we do with young people, about having a person as part of our team who's in law enforcement. Since these young people end up interacting with law enforcement, we need to set up more opportunities for positive interactions, for preventative measures on our campus, but also for when they graduate from our program and are out in society, as we grow them as an individual, that they can be successful in interacting in all walks of life. That's our mission. We're an educational institution, and we know they're going to age out at 21 in many of these programs, so we do as much as we can in that period of time. So the proposal to me, I thought, was pretty well thought out by our personnel, and we're looking forward to if we can get a school resource officer, to make them part of our team so that we can help make some decisions on what role everyone plays when we have students who get beyond our ability to de-escalate.
Thank you.
Welcome.
So that request came to us nearly a year ago. We've been in contact with them since then. I know everybody likes stats, so I'll give you some stats. They're always pretty cool. Since January of last year, so roughly 18 months ago, or 20 months ago, or whatever, there have been 171 calls for service to the 911 center, to the BOCES campus. By far, other than Pyramid Mall, the highest volume of calls that we respond to, that anyone responds to, in our jurisdiction. That doesn't count the city. So to us, we agreed with their need. Of course, we're always cognizant of finances. BOCES actually spoke with the districts that they represent and have been able to come up with a financial arrangement to pay for 75% of the cost, salary and benefits of this position. The other 25% is the OTR, and quite frankly, that person can be used by the sheriff's office when school is not in session, particularly summertime, to cover vacations, their own vacations, that sort of stuff.
Okay. So. Ready for questions? Questions?
There's no questions.
Dan Klein, then Shauna Black, then Martha Robertson.
Hi. I think I have two questions. So this person will be on whose payroll?
They are our FTE. They will be a county employee.
Okay.
BOCES will reimburse 75% of the cost.
Okay. And would this person have all the powers that any other member of your department has, any other officer has?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Shauna?
Yeah, I have a few questions. I was wondering how many social workers are currently on staff at BOCES?
Could you step to the microphone, please?
Good evening. David Barr, Director of Exceptional and Alternative Education. So as Dr. Madison mentioned, we've got a Turning Point Day Treatment Program, which has roughly 20 social workers in that program, which is a pretty high needs area. And then the Regional Alternative School, we've got a couple over there as well. We've got probably 25 or so counselors, 25 to 30 on campus.
And what is the ratio of student per healthcare?
So in the day treatment program at Turning Point, which is the most intensive one as well, is probably caseload is about six, maybe eight students.
Has it been increased over the years?
Well, our numbers are pretty static just because we don't have much space.
Okay.
So we're limited by that. And there are 811 programs there. So we have limits by how many students can actually attend.
Okay. Is there any reason why a local security agency couldn't do this job? Why the person has to be an armed person in a school?
I see an opportunity for us with somebody who we're not, the weapon is not what it's about on campus. It's an opportunity for us to build relationship. And as Dr. Madison also mentioned, we have students who have come in contact with law enforcement over the years. We've got a reason that the students are on campus. They've not been successful in the school, some of it for behavioral reasons. So I feel like it's an opportunity that and a responsibility we have to educate them and help them be more able to understand how law enforcement is there to help.
Okay. I believe that this is really going to open up a Pandora's box. I foresee if we do fund this, then other districts.
Well, we're just asking questions. We
right.
don't want to get
this
into
is actually,
statement.
This is part of a question.
Is there a question?
Yeah. So I want to know, from your perspective, if we were to offer this SRO to BOCES, how could you go to Dryden whenever they come to you and ask for an SRO? How could we say no to them? Or how could we say no to Trumansburg or Lansing or any of the other school districts that might want this and ask for taxpayers to pay for their SRO?
Again, they came to us for help. We can't do it without you folks. And in every case down the line, it would be the same thing. Except, I guess it would be conceivable if a district were to come to us to say, if we pay 100% of that, could you do that? And even in that case, you know, you're increasing an FTE, and I would imagine that we would still want the blessing of the legislature. To date, no one has done that. These are the only folks.
Martha?
I appreciate the BOCES, Mr. Madison, Mr. Barr, and hi, Kathy. I appreciate your being here. My question is about, so you said in the summertime this person would help us with what we've been talking about before, about having a lot of overtime because we have to cover things like vacations. Is that right? So this would be a fully, you know, trained and staffed, trained road deputy, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I thought Shauna's question was a good one. I didn't think it got answered. What a full-time security guard who is similarly trained, maybe not a sheriff's deputy, maybe not armed, but could they provide a similar kind of relationship? Of, you know, that what you're talking about makes does make sense in terms of having somebody who's part of it's what the theory of DARE is, right? The idea of having a relationship with the students. So why would that not suffice if it just to be a security officer, you know, some maybe retired professional?
Well, we're not looking for security officers, but I think the other issue is to try to not be making the calls for the additional assistance. We would hope that anyone who interacts would be able to help us with de-escalation, but we're not thinking someone who's not a current professional is going to have the same impact as part of our educational program.
Do you not have any other uniformed security person?
We have none.
So you understand what I'm saying? You can have a uniformed security person that's sort of a step up from your counselors, step up, whatever, you know, looks more official, more like law enforcement from your counselors, and in fact, not just looks, but is trained, but not a deputized law enforcement person.
Which it could be part of our education program. That's not what the request has come to me. We're also trying to prevent the additional time where we're taking people off the street to respond to our campus issues. So we know we have campus issues that will require law enforcement intervention on occasion. When you have it on the campus already, you've got the dual expectation that they can have the relationship with the students and also deal with those issues like any educational campus, large educational campus in our region has, to manage those situations for us rather than calling someone off the street. So we're looking for a current law enforcement professional, not one who used to be one or one that is in training. It certainly does require the right person. Which is why we would like to hire, you know, we certainly would be consulted in the hiring of the person because an SRO to be effective needs to be the right kind of person, and they certainly go with a very deep training. But our request is for the law enforcement professional.
Do we have any kind of record, I don't know which office it would be, of how many arrests have actually occurred? Well, you said 171 calls in a year and a half. An idea how many arrests actually followed?
I don't have those figures, no.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, time check. I've got four people on the list that want to speak. We are now 40 minutes over. This is our second presentation of the evening. We have five more after this. So I want you to think carefully about trying to keep things concise. Next is Henry Granison. Deborah, I have you on the list.
Did you ever consider, I know you talked about part-time hires at the airport, about hiring somebody part-time just to do this job?
No, because that wasn't the request from these folks.
The request is, but what difference does it make whether the request is for a full-time officer versus a part-time officer?
I think he spoke to that in that they want basically the same person, the one that all the people on campus recognize every day. Because they're getting different people now. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In the form of a 911 response.
So you can't hire someone who works three-quarters time?
Part-timers are held to a $30,000 maximum that they can make a year. So we wouldn't be able to put a part-timer in there full-time, even for 75%. They would hit that before. So you couldn't put part-timers and get what you want, one person there. Yeah. And having been a DARE officer for 17 years, and that's where SROs came from, okay, I can tell you the relationship that you build with the students is invaluable, and it does take the same person going to, and they are highly trained to make sure they make that connection with the youth of the school.
Anna Kellis.
Well, one thing I think, you know, that question is
there's the concern of having armed officers on campus. And I think that it's because of 911, there are armed officers on campus. During these episodes, the question is whether they're there full time and does that escalate situations that wouldn't otherwise be escalated. And I think that that is a concern that I know is relatively common. I think that's partly what you're hearing. I'm not sure we have a full answer to that on that point. But a couple questions that I did have. At BOCES, are there classes full year, like full all year round? Is there a need all year round?
We do have summer school programs.
And is the interest to have
No, we're our interest not right now to have a full-time all year round situation because we have a regional regular education summer school that beats up more than half our campus, and our regional special education programs are about half the size of what they are during the regular school year, and the other half of our building we use for the special education students that are out in our school district during the year. So we only keep about half of our own. So we believe in the summer we can manage.
So then my other question is that if you have secured 3/4, I'm just trying to understand the logistics of all of this. If you have secured money for 3/4 of a person and you don't get a fourth from this, would you not do it or can we not technically do it? I'm trying to understand. You had said that we can't do a 3/4 time because that's part-time and then we can't do it somehow.
Well, you can't, the math doesn't work for a part-time person to do 3/4 of a year.
Well, they would be paid 3/4. They're not paid part-time. They would be full-time for 3/4 of the year. They would be paid full-time for the school year.
I don't know. We've never hired 3/4 of a person.
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking teachers get off the full summer. You know, so, I mean, it does exist by many hundreds of thousands of people.
But can I interject? Isn't there a contract issue about that?
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to understand. What are the technical barriers?
Well, they're a 12-month position. So, I think we'd have to pay them regardless. And we certainly have work for them to do when they're not.
Right, which I hear. And I'm just asking that if it didn't go through, I hear that you want this position, and I respect that. I respect that you know your work more than we do. And I'm trying to understand, if this OTR does not go through, does that mean that this will not happen at all? Or is it possible to create legally a 9-month, regardless of what we feel? I'm just trying to get a sense of, is our decision a black or white decision for what is going to happen for you all?
Jason, do you want to respond?
I was just going to add that the reason you couldn't do a part-time position is, generally speaking, when you're hiring part-timers, they're usually retired former law enforcement officers. They're pulling New York State retirement pension. There's a cap on how much anyone in the New York State retirement system, when they're retired, can make in addition. So I just want to clarify, generally speaking, though, to answer what I think the undersheriff is saying, is you're not going to hire a 3/4 of a person. You have an obligation when you hire a full-time employee. You have to pay a full annual salary and wage. To hire a 3/4 of an FTE, it would have to be done through part-time employees. And I think to talk about that, you would have to have multiple part-time employees to successfully complete the 3/4 of the year.
So you can't create a 9-month contract?
No.
That's all I wanted to know.
Yep.
Mike Sigler.
I'll be quick. I'm just 171 calls. I'm assuming that you, and this is a question for BOCES, I'm assuming that you don't just call the police. I mean, I'm assuming a lot of things happen before you actually get on the phone. So, I mean, is that a pretty good assumption?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Deborah, wrap us up.
Thank you. I'm just curious about the implications of this being a county employee, despite the fact that BOCES would be reimbursing us for 75% of salary and fringes. I mean, what are the consequences of that being a full-time sheriff's employee if, for example, that person has to go out on disability, workman's comp, 207C? Are we obligated to provide another officer if that one is injured on the job? And who pays that officer's pension?
Who pays their pension? The pension costs are all part of the overall cost that's been figured out. In answer to your first question, if they get hurt on the BOCES campus, that is no different than if they got hurt today responding to a call on the BOCES campus.
Except that now you're obligated to provide another officer specifically for the BOCES campus.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you all for coming tonight. Thank you, folks from BOCES, for coming. We appreciate it. We aren't voting on this tonight, obviously. We were glad to hear the presentation. This is an important part of our expenditures in our county budget. Anybody need a break before we continue? 5 minutes. Okay. We have lots of wonderful presentations, but I have to admit that the prejudice of one of my favorites is the rural libraries. And I always have to disclose, of course, that I am a trustee of one of the rural libraries, the Southworth Library Association. And we have representatives from, I think, all the libraries here tonight, don't we?
Well, we did have a representative from Trumansburg, but she had to go pick up her child because it was getting late.
We apologize to her for our being long-winded.
Oh, well.
Diane Pamel, the director of the Southworth Library, is here. And do you want to introduce everybody?
Yes, I'll let them introduce themselves, and I'll try not to be long-winded.
This is on Section 5, page 42. There's one over target, which has been recommended.
So I am Diane Pamel from Southworth Library. I've been there quite a while now, 11 years as director.
I'm Sarah Glagowski. I'm the executive director of the Finger Lakes Library System, and I've been at Finger Lakes since 2015 and many years at Tompkins County Public Library before that.
Hi, I'm Susie Gutenberger. I am the director of the Lansing Library, and I have been there 10 years, as long as the library has been a chartered library.
Hello, I'm Tammy Kubinek-Smith. I am the director at the Newfield Public Library, and I have been there a little bit over 5 years.
So Cassandra Broadwell could not make it. Well, she's the one that left, and she is a new director at the Trumansburg Library, the Ulysses Bill Mathick Library in Trumansburg, and Sarah Knoble from Groton Public Library regrets she was not able to come tonight. So I wrote it down. I'm a librarian. As recently as last week, how close do I have to stand? Sit.
Michael says 6 inches.
Okay. All right. As recently as last week, New York Times published a piece on the relevance of public libraries. While bookstores are closing and publishers are paring down, libraries continue to see active use. Our circulation of materials has increased or remained steady, but it's not just books that people seek in their local library. If any of you happen to walk into any of the rural libraries, you'll notice a whole compendium of people and sometimes animals in the library. We are comfortable, friendly gathering places for community members of all ages. And we also provide access to technology, create learning environments for all ages, and reach beyond traditional literacy services. None of us has seen a decrease in the use of their library since I first started coming here 10 years ago. Some of us, especially after construction projects, if you build it, they will come, have seen a 500% increase for visitors and material circulation. Oop. Down, not up. Got it. We are the heart of our communities. Tompkins County covers a wide area, from the urban setting of Ithaca to our small rural communities and villages. In our rural areas, where geographic isolation and transportation issues remain a concern, our libraries have the pulse of our own communities and their unique needs. We provide wireless internet access, reference services, reader's advisory, job hunting and resume building support, assistance with ebook reading devices and apps. If anybody needs help, just ask us. And access to interlibrary loan services that reaches across the United States. We serve people from all walks of life as a vital community resource, whether for information needs, social connections, food insecurity, or access to vital services. There. Southworth Library in Dryden. You'll see some pictures there. In addition to our popular programs from children's teens and adults, we also developed some new programs and collaborations this year. We have a science-based book club with Cargill De-icing Technology Engineers, 3D printing with the Girls Who Code Club, which is assisted by students from Cornell University, and NASA My Library programs with Cornell University professors. Our community engagement series on politics, neighborhood, and history provided a platform for adult discussion and connection. Our outreach includes regular programs to the local Head Starts and daycare centers, the Willowbrook Senior Center, our schools. We were a summer lunch site this year, and we do a book club with the William George Agency. We were recognized as a Library Journal five-star library for the fifth year in a row in 2017, one of only 4% of all libraries nationwide. Our CERC topped 100,000 items this past year, and our summer reading increased 100%. We were lucky because the local McDonald's and Texas Roadhouse gave coupons to kids who finished their reading.
Do you want me to?
You.
Right. This is our Lansing slide. We have, besides having our 10-year anniversary, we've had some exciting things happen in Lansing this year. One, some of you might remember, is that we, historically, Lansing was the only library in Tompkins County whose municipality did not fund us in their own budget. We have our tax levy and other funding sources, but I'm happy to say that they just passed it in Lansing. They are going to fund us. Thank you. It was good. Mike was very helpful with that. So they are going to help support our summer reading this year, and they know it's just starting a conversation because we're starting to find funding in other ways. This year, our summer reading, we are really focusing on retention. We had about 425 people, kids and adults, register for summer reading, and then we're trying to keep them over the summer reading, not just coming to the program and registering. So we've seen a 25% increase in kids actually finishing our program and going through the whole year summer. So that was very exciting. You can see our ukulele class that we had over the summer, and also we had a large donation last year, late 2017, that afforded us to buy signage for the library. We are on a highway, and we'd be surprised at how many people would come in and say, I never knew there was a library here, when we're right on the highway between the school and like one of the local bars. I don't know why they didn't see us. But now we have this beautiful new sign that we can has a reader board, we can announce our programs, and then in the front of the library, you'll see we were able to put people don't ask me if I'm town hall anymore because now we have the Lansing Library signage, which is surprisingly important, but was way outside of our operating budget. So that was a great local woman gave us that money. So
I would just go for the cake.
I know, right?
You know,
the cake was also donated. Somebody won it at an auction and then said, I'm going to give you the cake for your anniversary. So that was great.
Can we get a name?
So this year, the Ulysses Philomathic Library in Trumansburg led the way for the popular Empire Pass cards to the New York State Parks, an initiative that many of the other libraries added. If you aren't aware of that, you could go to the library and check out the pass and get into the park without paying for it. The library added a new librarian, an after-school makerspace, and an anime club, along with popular family story times, baby story times with a local nursery school, outreach at the farmers market, and the Jacksonville WIC Clinic. For adults, The library offered regular author visits, concerts, book clubs, educational classes, as well as hosting weekly meetings of artists, chair yoga for exercise, which you might need by the end of this night, language learners, and knitters. Their outreach service also included collaborating with schools, regular rotation of large type books to local senior living facilities, and book giveaways at Grassroots and the Fireman's Parade. Groton Public Library has increased their programming by significantly with a 64% increase in attendance. The greatest need for Groton right now has been the limitations of their space. Their programs are so popular that some of their regulars are complaining it's a little noisy. So they actually did some great work getting some space for an addition that they're committed to a 2,000 square foot expansion behind the existing building with funding that was recommended by Senator James Seward and Assemblywoman Barbara Lifton. They got a total of $700,000 committed to that project. Yay, Groton. So the new large space is desperately needed for them. And just a recommendation for Director Sarah Noble, if there's a need in that community, she looks for a way to be part of solving it. So if you walked into her library this summer, you would see a big table with bags of cabbage because that's what they had, and many other, and potatoes. She's a food resource for her community, which is so helpful, especially with the grocery store closing. So I did not get to leave without taking a cabbage.
Hello. So Newfield Public Library has had an interesting and exciting year. We found out at the beginning of the year that we needed a new roof. So we have spent a good portion of this year raising the funds to replace our roof, and we have met our in-house goal and are looking for grant funding for the rest of it. So that's one of the things going on. And under that roof, we have many, many things going on, similar to what you have heard from the other libraries. We are offering programming for, I think our youngest patron that attends programming right now is 4 months old. And our oldest, they don't like to share their age as much, but they're in their 90s. So we are really offering programming, story times, book groups, music classes, art classes, are going on all the time at the Newfield Public Library. One of the other things that I know that we are not alone in is our efforts at collaboration with our community. We collaborate with our local recreation department to offer activities for children and also youth employment opportunities. Newfield is a small rural community with a pretty big poverty problem, which is not unfamiliar to most of the rural communities. And one of the things that we are doing is collaborating to offer employment opportunities for teenagers. And so each year we have been able to employ more and more teens in our community, and we're really proud of that. The other thing that we have been doing recently is collaborating with a new group in Newfield. We have a group called, I'm going to forget the name, it's the concert series at Mill Park. So there has been a community effort to bring more recreational activities to the town of Newfield, and so we have this committee that has been working on bringing concert series to Newfield. They're really good. You should check them out if you've got a Wednesday night free. It is, yes, it is on the website. And so we have been collaborating with that group so that we are, 1 week they will have a concert series for older individuals, and then the next week we will do a concert or a program series for families and children. So I think we could probably go on all night about the things that we are offering in our community, but those are just a few of the new interesting things we've been doing at Newfield. I apologize, I lost my train of thought. I guess that's it. Thank you.
And if any of you have any great ideas and you want to do them at the library, we're happy to do them.
So Finger Lakes Library System is not a public library, but think of us, the best way I can describe it to people that aren't familiar with library systems is we're a library for libraries. So we're not open to the public, but we service 33 libraries in 5 counties. We have Cayuga County, Cortland County, Seneca County, Tioga County, and Tompkins County. And we provide services to all 33 of our libraries. Think of us as a vital link that connects all of our libraries. So we do behind-the-scenes type of services for our member libraries. We know that our libraries are short-staffed. They're under budget. We help them be the best libraries for their communities. We provide continuing education for them. We provide some consortium pricing for things such as e-content. When you download an e-book or an e-audiobook, we provide digital e-magazines, streaming videos and TV series. We also provide consortium prices for databases. And the library catalog, when you search for a book to see if it's in your local library, whether it be at your local library or from the comfort of your smartphone or at home, we are the ones that are providing that catalog for everyone. So think of us as a consortium purchaser for our member libraries. So one of the things that is most used for all of our libraries, Tompkins County, delivery is always ranked highest. The movement of books happens Monday through Friday. We have 2 vans that are out from 8:30 a.m. till 4:30 p.m. Delivering to 33 libraries. Almost all of our libraries get 4 to 5 day deliveries, and our smallest libraries get 2 days a week, but the majority of our libraries get deliveries 4 to 5 times a week. Our largest library, Tompkins County Public Library, actually is the only one. They get delivery in the morning and the afternoons. They get delivery twice a day. So we do a massive amount of interlibrary loan, as you can see with these statistics up here. So think of it in intra-library loan, like the movement between the 33 member libraries, and then we're unique also because of our location, especially with Cornell, Ithaca College, Wells College, TC3, other organizations like that. We do a tremendous amount of out-of-system interlibrary loan where you can actually get books from anywhere in the United States. So a tremendous amount of interlibrary loan services that we provide. We do that all in-house up at our facility. And then just kind of, bringing up again that what we do is very valuable to our small libraries. So we do workshops, we do system trainings, again, the delivery of books, the interlibrary loan, consultations. So we are the guidelines and help our member libraries with state minimums. All of our libraries have to meet state minimums. Things that are coming out, like the new sexual harassment training, we really take the lead on for member libraries. We also help them do grants, whether it be local community grants or state grants that we are allotted every year.
So our challenges continue to be increased costs for digital needs and advancing technology, minimum wage and living wage standards for our staff, and the increased complexity of library services. So, there we go. The 2% increase will help us to keep that in line and continue to provide our operations at the level that we are in the ever-changing landscape. So we thank you very much. So one fact that's constantly stressed by the American Heart Association, cardiac arrest can happen anywhere. Heart disease is the second highest cause of death in Tompkins County, with 138 deaths per 100,000, followed by chronic lower respiratory diseases at 35 per 100,000. According to the Tompkins County Department of Emergency Response, 451 emergency response calls in 2017 were related to stroke, heart problems, or cardiac arrest. But death, from sudden cardiac arrest is preventable if a bystander quickly retrieves and applies an automated external defibrillator, which I'll use AED from now on. In those first few minutes after a person goes into cardiac arrest, immediate action must be taken with a defibrillator, the AED, thank you, to provide the shock. After the shock, the person can be stabilized. Every minute that goes by without it being done lessens a person's chance of survival by 10%. As fire extinguishers protect from a fire, an AED protects people from sudden cardiac death. On average, less than 8% of people who experience an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest survive. However, death from a cardiac arrest is preventable if a bystander quickly retrieves and applies an AED. So, New York State requires AEDs at public institutions in buildings, health clubs, swimming facilities, and dental offices, though not currently at most libraries. However, having an AED in the local library is not just a precaution, it's a necessity. People of all different ages and backgrounds frequent libraries, not only for books, but for social gatherings and community meetings. Approximately 158,000 people came through our rural library locations last year. And libraries regularly host senior exercise classes, discussions that might get heated, and public events. And although no one ever wants to think of a cardiac arrest happening in the local library, it can happen, as Susie will tell you.
Well, it's actually happened in Lansing 3 times in the 10 years I've been there, but just last week we have a class through Lifelong that's Tai Chi for older adults, and we had a gentleman who had a mini stroke and a small heart attack right after the class, and we were able to get him in a chair, and he was okay in the 22 minutes it took for Bangs to actually get to Lansing. So, and this is average. I mean, every time we've called, I've talked to Bangs about this. It's just, I don't know, I guess our location, but it does take about 20 minutes for someone to be able to get to Lansing. It's definitely very necessary. It's a little bit scary, and it's also the training, because I had paid last year to have our staff trained for CPR, and they did a little AED training, even though we didn't have the apparatus in our library. But I realized that I need more training. It was really scary as a director, because everyone looked to me to figure it out. So the training that goes along with the AED is very important too.
So I'll quickly just get to that since it's late. So everyone knows about the opioid crisis. Drug overdoses claim more lives than car accidents in the U.S., and one library even reported finding a used syringe on their property in their yard. And that's just the one that reported it. So, and of course, I looked up how to say this, but I'm going to just say Narcan. Naloxone? Has been a safe, effective tool in the arsenal of emergency responders, saving thousands of lives from overdose. Between 1996 and 2014, the drug saved more than 26,000 lives. Narcan can be the difference between life and death for someone experiencing an overdose, so it's important that it's readily available, Senator George Amador said. Libraries are gathering centers for a community, so it's common sense that they be prepared in case they're faced with this type of emergency. So we were a little nervous about that at first because of the training, which is a huge part of it. We want to have, none of us wants to have on our conscience that something could have been done to prevent someone else going into either a cardiac event or a drug overdose, and we didn't do anything about it. But it's also a little challenging to think about being the one doing it. So with this OTR, we would like to, it includes training for each of us, for our staff members, as well as the AED devices. And the Narcan kits are available through Governor Cuomo, I think, for free. So that's what we would like. We would like to be prepared so that we're not in the position of an emergency happening. Like Susie said, it took 25 minutes for the responders to get there. And we don't want that on our conscience if we don't have to have it.
One other thing to note, too, is that a lot of our libraries are the only open public space in our communities. And like, we're open 46 hours a week, so we're open when I think the town hall actually in Lansing doesn't have an AED machine. I thought they did. So there's not one in Lansing that's available besides the schools. So we are open those evening hours, and on Saturdays there's just a little more chance that if somebody even on my campus that has a community center and the town hall, that we could save a life if we had it.
So a reason public libraries are seen as such important third place institutions is that they and their librarians have taken on functions other than lending out books. In many communities, we help people figure out the complexities of life, from navigating the health system to helping people with housing needs. The go-to role has influenced library programming and events as we provide advice and connections to health, housing, literacy, and other areas. Each one of us promises to write a book about the weird things that have happened in our libraries. So we love what we're doing, we love who we're serving, and we so appreciate your support that you have given us over so many years.
Thank you so much. Other questions? Ann Corman, then Shauna Black.
Not really a question, but I'll try to make a quick comment. I want to thank you for several months back of having all the freshman legislators and you guys from all the libraries come and tell us more about what you guys were doing, and a delicious lunch, I might add. And one question I didn't ask then, and I don't, well, I know we're running late on time, but if you ever want to send me information, you know, the county is trying to get, you know, off of fossil fuels, more energy efficient. So if there's things that you guys are doing, please let us know, you know, whether it's your HVAC systems in addition, or if you're getting need new vans. And so we might be able to help you with some resources through the planning department. I'm not positive. We have somebody that helps with businesses. I don't know if they can help with the libraries, but just want to say that.
Yeah, just to point out, New York State currently is giving out $34 million in library construction aid. That is a massive increase from previous years. We don't think it's going to occur again next year. Our board, the Finger Lakes board, you apply through Finger Lakes, and our board, the Finger Lakes board, actually votes to approve the money. We're voting Wednesday. We are giving out over $930,000 to a variety of our libraries. And it does do, for instance, the Ulysses Library used it recently to get, the solar panels. Groton will be getting money from us on Wednesday night to do their expansion, in addition to their $700,000 that they got from Seward and Lifton. So our libraries do take advantage of it. Our libraries are built at a time, some of them over 100 years ago, when they are old houses. We have one that was an old funeral home in Apalachin in Tioga County. We have an old doctor's home also in Tioga County in Nichols, New York. These libraries, a lot of times, were from wealthy individuals that willed their houses then to the community, so they weren't built for libraries. There were no children's rooms in libraries 100 years ago. There were no community rooms in libraries until recently. And our libraries are being used in different ways. And so what we're finding is a record number of libraries having to undergo construction projects. There are 756 libraries in New York State. I was on a state call last Tuesday. 308 out of 756 are applying for construction projects this year alone.
Any other questions? We had Shauna.
Hi there. I just want to thank you for being receptive to administering Narcan. I also wanted to see, have you signed up for training for that?
Yes, and a lot of our libraries have. And actually, last week, I was appointed. I'm the only regional rep appointed by New York State. I'm on the opioid response committee through New York State Libraries. NYLA, the New York State Library Association, recommends that individuals give out Narcan. We are doing a state survey right now. Many libraries are doing it on an individual basis. We have a high opioid addiction problem in our service area in the five counties. I was contacted by the state last year. Out of the five counties we serve, four are considered higher risk for opioid addiction and issues. We see it a lot in our local libraries. It might not be publicized, but it is happening. So a lot of our libraries have been trained. We just had a training actually at the end of July, beginning of August, from our Regional Library Council. A lot of us have the kits, so yes.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. We thank you all. I'm sorry, Martha had her hand up.
Yeah, that was part started to get to my question, which is the I understand the one-time funding for the kits and the AEDs, the equipment, but how often does the training have to be done?
For the AED, that I'm not sure of, unfortunately.
And then Narcan?
Yeah, the Narcan, you get a card, and then you do have to renew it. And most of our libraries have just done it within the past year.
Okay, I mean, it's not a big amount of money, but so it's for both. Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for waiting for us. And we're going next to the Youth Services and Recreational Partnership issues. This is section 4 of your big book, page 278. There are three over targets, all of which have been recommended, and we are 1 hour and 3 minutes over. Amy Hendricks.
Hi, Mike. Hi, everyone. So this is the Youth Services 2019 budget presentation. And I always begin our budget presentation with bringing you to the mission of the Youth Services Department. Since we are a department that does not serve youth directly, I think it's important to remind folks what we do is provide time, resources, and fundings in the different communities to help them support the young people that we work with. So here is our recommended budget. There are a few changes, which I could talk about in more depth if we'd like, but basically there's some changes in shifting of revenues due to position changes and moving revenues. We had had a contract with county administration to provide results-based accountability. That contract is no longer in place, so that's gone to administration. Along with that, there has been a smaller request. Some funding flows to the Youth Services Department or through the Youth Services Department to the Ithaca Youth Bureau Recreation Support Services through city sales tax through the city sales tax agreement. There was a slightly smaller request this year than in previous years. So those are two highlights for some of these changes. As far as full-time equivalents, you'll see we are down a full-time equivalent. A little bit different than that. So we reorganized this year due to some of those changes that I mentioned on the previous slide. So as we enter 2019, you'll see that change. I would not present this without the pyramid, and Joe let me know he's watching. He's expecting a holographic pyramid. I told him we're not quite there yet, although this is the pyramid of youth services. And it divides up into how we look at funding the services in the community. So we start by funding at the recreation partnership level, which is universal prevention. At the bottom of the pyramid, we're hoping to capture the most young people served, and usually those are our least costly services. As you move up the pyramid, the services become a little more intensive. So the next level is the early intervention and youth development services. Predominantly, we provide these services through the Municipal Youth Service System. That system is in every municipality across the county, and we work with local municipal planning groups in each municipality. The next layer is our targeted intervention services, and those are provided through agency services. This is done through an RFP process. We have a multi-year contract with many agencies to provide those services, and they include things like runaway and homeless youth programs, as well as programs that are more intensive in the after-school realm. At the very top is an area where we don't provide current funding for, but we do support in a variety of ways, and that's where we fall into treatment and residential placement. So those services are provided predominantly by the Department of Social Services and through the juvenile justice system. This is where a lot of the Raise the Age programming comes from. So while we may not be providing direct financial support, we do provide a lot of time and resources as we look at how we're planning services throughout the community. So as I mentioned at the bottom, we're hoping to serve the most amount of young people, and those are usually the least costly per person. And then as you move up the pyramid, the more costly the service per person, and hopefully less people are served so we can capture them at the bottom. In our budget, we have three over-target requests, which have been supported by the county administrator. The over-target requests offer structural support and system sustainability for the municipal youth service system. That's a $50,000 request that looks at how do we continue to operate that system in the most efficient manner. The second over target is a cost of living adjustment for our contractors. This is provided to the contracts that we have within the Youth Services Department. So while other agencies receive that 2% increase on an annual basis, our contractors don't automatically receive that. We've asked for this each time that the others have received it, just to continue to keep them at the level. The other piece on this is we're only requesting this 2% increase on our county funding. It does not include state or other funding that we may be passing through to those contractors. And then the third request is for our Achieving Youth Results PITCH program, which we started last year and are still exploring. So one of the challenges that we've had as a department, we've been around for 40 years, and we often fund similar programs. We do great work with needs assessments, find out new community interests, how we can better support young people. And what we want to do is be able to build off of what we're already doing to allow others to start to try different tactics. So the next picture here is some of our municipal and agency services. These are some of the young people served, I think predominantly this past year, some of them actually this summer. So this is just a snapshot of the different types of activities and different ages that we serve. This slide that you can see much closer is about the PITCH contest. So the PITCH program, this was our first year operating the program. And through it, we funded, I always get this number wrong, eight PITCH program contestants. They each competed for up to $5,000 per program of matching funds. So we were able to not only just provide what we had, but they were able to increase that. All of the PITCH contestants had about a month and a half to develop what they were looking for. They used the needs assessments that we had provided and came up with programs based on that. One of the outcomes to this is we actually funded, I believe, out of the eight, we had previously worked with a few of them, but they were all expanded programs that we hadn't really worked with before. So this gave an opportunity for them to do something different and also listen to young people. One of the contestants talked about a 10-year-old that worked in their Just Play program who didn't have any summer care, spent the day with them, and then brought their friends. And so it's something different than we would typically do, and that's the Just Play project, which is safe adults that are in the park that are trained play professionals, helping young people get out and active, teaching them actually how to play, which is something that you don't always think about for a 10-year-old not knowing what a tire swing is and how to play on that. So that's just a side story that they were able to share. And we're still collecting data on that as it's ongoing throughout the year. And this is just a glimpse of last year marked our 40th anniversary. And so we were able to once again think about the adults that shaped our community. And we were able to recognize 40 caring adults in the community. We recognized many more than 40. But we were able to select 40 adults that had shaped a lot of what Youth Services is doing, how they provide that backbone support, and the different ways that our community moves forward to support young people. And that will conclude the piece on the Youth Services budget. Do you want me to do a rec partnership or stop here for questions?
I think, of course, Martha has a question on this, so go ahead, Martha.
This is time well spent, I think. The OTR, the first OTR, $50,000 for structural support and system sustainability. You've got a long description. Can you, which I haven't had a chance to read. So,
sure.
That's a lot of money and it's target. So can you tell us more about it?
So this actually goes back to the Municipal Youth Service System that received a large reduction in funding in 2010 during that economic downturn. When the reduction in funding occurred, so that system was cut in half or a little more, when that occurred, we decided that we would continue to provide as much support to the municipalities as possible. So we, within that system, we contract with Cooperative Extension to provide the system program monitoring. And what we did is we continued to provide as much funding to the municipalities, but we reduced the administrative costs as much as possible. What we found is through time, that hasn't been a very smart method of continuing to support that. Because when you continue to reduce the administrative costs and you have program managers in every municipality, we aren't able to continue to keep that structure. And so what we're seeing, symptoms of that we're seeing, is making sure that the vans are where they need to be and their maintenance is well kept starts to weaken. Making sure that the training records and all of that is up to date. Making sure that all of the performance requirements that are placed on these program managers are really being activated. So that's what that funding does, is it'll allow us to bring back a position we eliminated as results to those major reductions.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you move on to rec partnership, please?
Sure. So this one's going to be very straightforward. This is the Recreation Partnership, which is a municipal agreement with all of the other municipalities except for the town of Lansing, who does not participate in the Recreation Partnership. This is the recommended budget. All other municipalities have also recommended a 2% increase in the partnership budget. And that's it.
Further questions? Thank you. There's Anna with her hand up, of course.
How many questions have I actually asked tonight?
15
parts. Yeah. Thing that I think might be worth explaining in the 2% that the Recreation Partnership was able to do the 2% with some structural changes that actually created a lot of efficiencies mm-hmm. and allowed for increased programming. I thought maybe you could speak to the group a little bit about that.
Very little. So each year, the Recreation Partnership Agreement is the Ithaca Youth Bureau is the major contractor behind that agreement. And so they're always given the parameters of developing ways to ensure that the programming is maintained. And so when they do that, they look at what the actual costs are to maintain that programming. And then if they were to meet our target. So this year, the 2% is supported in your budget. If they were to meet that, what would they have to change or shape? This year, they were able to look at that and look at different programs with the help of the Recreation Partnership Board as well as some of the youth services staff to identify cost savings as well as areas where fees could actually be increased or participant, how they can use participant scholarships can also be changed. So that's what they were able to do, and they really met this 2% while increasing programming, not decreasing programming, which is not typical when you talk about what actual costs are versus what we're able to provide.
And the reason I say that is because the last 3 years, to do a maintenance of effort, they've had to come to with an OTR to us every time. And since there's new legislators, I just wanted them to know that it was very well done this year, that they maintained, kept under with some unique switches, increasing programming. I don't think it'll happen again necessarily because they found a lot of the any kind of tweaks they could do. Mm-hmm. But I was quite impressed.
Well, thank you. Amy, we're very proud of what the work that our Youth Services Department and all your staff do for us and for the children in Tompkins County. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We'll go next to assessment. Section 4, page 5, 1 OTR, number 24. It's been recommended. Jay Franklin.
Thank you. I was going to say, don't forget the person who makes me look good all the time. Well, hopefully this will be nice and quick, and we'll be out of here in 10 minutes, right? I'm missing my update on the zombie goldfish book tonight, so I don't know if I'm going to be able to catch up tomorrow once we get to the next chapter. Yeah, it's pretty bad. Little overview of our overall budget. It kind of looks a little odd with the additional revenue we had. The majority of that is included in our OTR request. Of $20,000 of that for the for our first OTR. I also finally started budgeting additional revenue for printing tax bills. I've kind of been hesitant in the past because BOCES can do it cheaper, but we do it better. So that's why Ithaca City School and Newfield stay with us. So I'm going to finally realize that, and I guarantee 19 they'll go to somebody else to do it cheaper. Also included is the purchase of a couple new field computers. We're finally going to be able to go mobile with our new state-provided CAMA, computer-assisted mass appraisal database. So hopefully my appraisers will be spending less time in the office and more time out in the field doing field work. Kind of our major influences, they're pretty much not anything that you haven't heard me already speak about over the years. We still have a very strong real estate market here in Tompkins County. You know, only go outside and count the cranes. All of the new apartments being built have just been built or will about to be built. New hotels, you know, we're probably going to review around 15,000 parcels this year as part of our normal annual equity maintenance program. For size, the Tompkins County is about 36,000 parcels. So we'll be reviewing a little less than half of the parcels based strictly upon what the real estate market's doing. A thing that really affects me the most, and also Tammy and Irene, is the increase in legal research that we've had to do for various exemptions and tax status. All of the NYSEG smart meters that you've seen have popped up. They're on a telephone pole. That telephone pole is taxable. The antenna, NYSEG has told the state that it's not taxable. I wish I could tell New York State that my house isn't taxable as well, but we're digging around researching that. So all of the poles, wires, and cables that run along the road are all taxable entities and things that we have to pick up and value. The 5G antennas that are going to be coming down, the broadband towers, So I'm spending a lot of time researching the taxability or accessibility of these small ticket items, but there's a lot of time that goes in and researching these items. Electric vehicle charging stations is another one. What's the value of it, and what's the contributory value of that? So as these are popping up across our county, we have to figure out what the value is, and more importantly than who owns it, who got the money, who gets the money when they're charged. So it's a good thing I didn't have hair to begin with. Another aspect is not-for-profit exemptions. We review the real property tax law, but we also review the court decisions that have occurred, and it's always fun trying to figure out what's a charitable use and whether that applies for an exemption. And the comptroller's office is getting a little more providing a little more scrutiny for these exemptions, so I'm trying to go through and making sure that I have an original application for a cemetery from 1812 on file. Because if the comptroller comes and I don't have that application, I'll get dinged for it. So I'll have to blame Chloe Cholesterol on that one for not having those applications. Maybe one of you know Chloe. I could see Mike probably remembering Chloe.
We can tell you where there's some 1812 soldiers buried.
Increase in demand for real property information. Every day I get multiple requests. Can you run this report? Can you run that report? Do you have this data? Not just from property owners, but from municipalities as they're looking at revising zoning. Irene just spent the night out in Ulysses to look at their rezoning and how that may affect value. So. What's next? Increase in complexity of real estate transactions and just property types as well. Solar farms, ground leases. I'm pretty sure pretty soon we're going to have to get into air rights as well and try to segment out who owns the floor, who owns the second and third floor, and then who owns everything else up above. You have the 1031 exchanges. From someone buying or selling a commercial property and needing to buy something else in order to not take a income tax hit. So we're seeing more deals that actually involve the income tax side as opposed to a purchase price just based upon the value of the real estate itself. And that we're talking commercial properties here and not houses. And then we get into the least value versus the value of the building. I've talked to you before on BJ's on this. BJ sold for $16.8 million. The bricks and mortar up there are not worth $16.8 million, but the credit worthiness of BJ's as a tenant is what caused that sale to occur at $16.8 million. If you've read anything, you've heard dark store, the dark store theory that's really affecting the Midwest. I've been monitoring that. I taught a course last summer in 18 to New York State assessors about the dark store theory and the build-to-suit properties. So I think I have a handle on what not to do, but you never know when the courts are involved and judges who are not appraisers are making decisions. Another thing that's going to take up a lot of our time coming up is we're a pilot county for IAS World or ACES, Assessment Community Enterprise System. When I Googled it, it was Adverse Childhood Experiences, which version 4, our current state database, is that for me. So this is definitely a step in the right direction, but I've been spending at least one day a month out in Albany going to these pilot meetings. I also got asked to serve on the valuation team. So there's a lot of steps to take our current state database and just map where all of our data items need to go in the new database. That's an impressive display that the state technology office is doing, but we're still got to figure out how it's going to be applicable and how we're going to use it. We'll have to train our staff, and more importantly, we're going to have to figure out how everything else interacts with this database. Between our tax bills, our exemption databases, how we give data to 911, to our county GIS. Luckily, most of the things we use in office I created or maintain now, so I'll be able to update it with our new extracts, but that's going to be time and effort for me to do that. Then the big one, succession planning. Irene's guaranteed that she's going to work for another 25 years. So we'll be good to go on that. But I do have a very, very good office. The only time you leave my office is when you retire. So I think that's a very good sign on what we do and the culture Irene has developed in there. It's just been fun. But, you know, I think we do like to have fun in our office, and that's why people have stayed. We will be losing our longstanding tax mapper. She's announced her plans to retire, and you just can't replace 32 years of experience and knowing offhand how much a rod in a chain is and how to be able to find old military lots and some of the descriptions that Vicki is able to take on paper and put on a map is just really impressive. So Vicki's really going to be missed, and I hope her the best when she does decide on her date for retirement and get many years out of it. But also with that, in the next 5 to 7 years, I'm going to see a lot more people like Irene who are doing 2-3 people's jobs. And that bill is going to come due. Typically, I would want to see our office at about 15 individuals. We're at about 12.2, mainly because Irene can do more. Vicki can do more. Al can do a full and a half-time job and part-time work in his partial retirement. The work that Tammy does processing exemptions. I don't know of any other assessor office as 36,000 parcels that has one person that processes all the senior and veterans exemptions. That's just unheard of on what she does. So it's really just impressive there. So here's my typical slide that you've seen every year, and looks like our staffing is going up from 11 to 12.2, but you forget back in 2000 we had 19 individuals. We went down in 2011. We kind of reorged when the county was doing an across-the-board budget cuts. I asked for a little bit more cut so that Joe wouldn't touch me in future years. As 105% of my budget is staff salary, I couldn't do it without cutting people, unfortunately. But we reorganized. We kind of rebuilt. According to the IAAO, the International Association of Assessing Officers, we should be at about 14.7 people. But because of the people we have, we're good right now on 12.2. Next year, maybe you'll see a little bit more. We have one over-target request. We're going to replace our old Jeep Liberty that's probably literally being held on by duct tape. It doesn't seem like a week or a month goes by that a piece of the car doesn't make it into our office. So it's a good time to replace it in cooperation with county administration. We said, you know, can we sell this Jeep and we'll replace it with a full electric vehicle, something like a smart car. I think that would be great to see Jason and I get out of a smart car at a meeting. So, but hopefully with that would be good for our meetings that we go to and some of our driving. Obviously, it's not going to be great for our rural field work where we need the four-wheel drive, but I think for the city, the town of Ithaca work would be great because you'll be able to move that little car in and out. When I started, we had a little Dodge Omni, and I love that thing. You could pretty much sneak in anywhere and sneak out, and nobody could see you being that low to the ground. But That's our budget. Irene, did you want to add anything? Did I miss anything?
No, we're not good because of me. We're good because of Jay and I together. And those of you that have known, Jay was born in the assessment office. 8 years ago, he had three kids born in the assessment office, so someday I think one of them will be sitting here in front of the future county legislators, but we're good because of how we work together.
I will warn them more than my dad warned me.
Thank you. Are there questions? Jay, as I've said before, there is life after hair. Anna Kellis.
So I've asked a few other people this. I do not question at all Vicki's worth, which actually makes me think that truly no one could do her job and truly no one could train her as well to do her job than her. Have you thought about having an overlap once she gives you a date of her request? And is that an OTR that you discussed with Jason potentially?
Yeah. She announced just after we presented the budget. I should have enough savings in the personnel line from not hiring a project assistant at the beginning of the year. And I'm hopefully meeting with personnel on Wednesday to talk about a recruitment plan. And ideally, we'll have a replacement or a new GIS technician. I can't replace Vicki, in order to come in and have at least a 1 to 2 month overlap with her.
And do you think that's enough given what she knows? And
well, it's going to have to be.
No. Other questions? Arthur Robertson.
Jay, I thought you went up in 2018 1.2 FTEs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was for overlap for retirements, right?
Yes. That Al had retired. He came back to work. He's a half-time position in that. And then we also have a 0.7 position of a project assistant. So we try to hire at the beginning of the year during our exemption period and assessment review period. And I've always wanted to hire in November or December to get someone trained, but we've always seemed to have to hire in January for that. So it's really Al's half-time position and then the project assistant. From there.
Okay. We've had some conversation about the boards of assessment review. And remind me, where's that coming down and about?
Dan?
Tomorrow morning, Wednesday morning, we're having our GO meeting.
To discuss it.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Who else? Ann Corman.
Thanks, Jay and Irene. I had just one question. We've had a couple of departments talk about getting electric vehicles or hybrid plug-ins, and are you working with the planning department or facilities about getting chargers?
Yep, we're working with both. We're working with facilities to get a charging unit on our back of our building. I know they've talked with ITS and Board of Elections to see what their future plans are. And, of course, working with Scott over in planning and hopefully being able to get a little extra money on that and then also his input on really what we would get. You know, I've looked at the Leaf, the Fiat, the 4.2 smart car, and also the Volkswagen e-Golf as well as four ones that I've researched and looked at. And, you know, I really think the smart car would be the way to go.
What's the range on that?
I forget. I have to go back to my notes.
But you just need it for around town.
Yeah.
So it doesn't
yes.
really matter.
Correct. We're really, you know, it's not something that we would be going out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to look at time. We don't really measure by mileage in our cars. You know, we may spend 6 hours in a car and be out in the and go 10 miles. We spend a lot of time just kind of puttering around.
Because if it's, you talked about, if it's you and Jason, we could get a tandem bicycle. Just think about it.
I like it.
You assist on it, you know, for the hills.
When,
right?
when we purchased the Prius way back when, 10 years ago, we realized they don't charge laptops when you're out in the field. So luckily, with newer mobile technology, hopefully we'll also have to take that into consideration as well, and maybe the battery life on our new laptops, including the budget, won't have to be charged every 30 seconds.
Okay. You should have came to me. I adapted my car to be able to do that. My Prius.
Where were you 10 years ago?
Thank you both. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
You did a lot of work for us. We thank you. We're going to Workforce New York Career Center. This is section 4 of your book, page 273. There are no over targets. We've picked up 3 minutes. You're only 57 minutes over.
Well, thank you so
much. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you so much.
Welcome, Teresa.
And thank you so much, everyone, for the opportunity to speak to you tonight about the Workforce Development Board and the Tompkins Workforce New York Career Center budget. I'm Julia Maddock. I'm executive director of the Tompkins County Workforce Development Board, and this is Terry Carlson. Terry is the manager of the Tompkins Workforce New York Career Center and the county's Office of Employment and Training. And what we're going to do, we're tag teaming this. We're going to present the Workforce Development Board budget, and then Terry will jump into her budget. And if we do, our hope is if we do both of them, one right after another, it'll eliminate some of the questions that we might have individually. Hopefully those will be answered with any questions you have for me might be answered with Terry's presentation. So
go right ahead.
Go ahead. Okay, so the Workforce Development Board budget specifically, the Workforce Development Board is part of the CD fund for the county, and in order for the county to provide resources to the Workforce Development Board, transfers have to happen between the CD fund, our general fund, and the CD fund. So where you find in your budget book information on the net local for the Workforce Development Board is actually in the inter-fund transfer section. For the purposes of tonight, I'm just going to say what it says is that the local funding for the Workforce Development Board is $130,533. Just a two-second overview on the Workforce Development Board. The Workforce Development Board is a 24-member board, private sector-led. I will say that the board chair changed on July 1, 2018. The board chair is Scott Pronte. He's the vice president of human resources with Tompkins Trust Company. On the board, in addition to private sector businesses, are agencies that are providing, not proving, providing workforce services. Sorry about that. Terry caught that right before we walked over here. There's union representation, educational representation with actually Dr. Madison from TST BOCES is on the board, as well as Dr. Montague from TC3. Both of them are also represented on the board. And then economic development, just to give you a sense of the categories of individuals that are a part of the Workforce Development Board. I'll say that What we attempt to do on the board is make sure that we have a mix of small, medium, and large businesses, and that those businesses represent multiple sectors of businesses in this community, and also that the folks that are on the board representing those businesses have different roles within their organizations. So, for example, we have someone who's general counsel for a company. We have CFOs. We have human resources folks, and we have CEOs, just so that we make sure that we have a nice representation on the board of different skill sets and different sectors of the economy. And the role of the board, kind of in a nutshell, is to make decisions around how federal dollars are invested, around how policies that govern how the resources that are invested, and then to work on specific strategies to assist businesses in different sectors to obtain the skilled workforce that they need, and then to assist job seekers with accessing the job opportunities in our community, and to also assist them with moving up the career ladder and providing them the opportunity to compete for better job opportunities. So that gives you sort of in a nutshell the Workforce Development Board. The board administers over $1.5 million in federal, state, and local funds for workforce services. And let me just say, they do have really complex fiscal and program requirements. I know that I've talked to this body before about the amount of monitoring that we receive from the New York State Department of Labor. It's outrageous, the amount of monitoring that we receive. And just to give you a sense in October, they're coming on site for 6 straight days to look at expenditures in every month of the previous year, make sure they're all supported with adequate documentation, they were claimed properly, that we claim dollars from the state properly. It just gives you a sense of we're very over-monitored, and that's just on the fiscal side, not on the program side. We're also monitored on the program side, absolutely. As I said, it's about $1.5 million in federal, state, and local dollars. And then we have multiple contractors. The board itself does not provide services. We have multiple contractors. And one of those contractors happens to be Terry Shop with the Tompkins County Office of Employment and Training. We have other contractors, but Terry Shop is a big part of is one of our larger contractors. Just to give you a sense of some of the funding that we administer, there's the Federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act funding that's broken into 3 separate categories. We administer funding through the state Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance Office, and that is for the Summer Youth Employment Program. The Ticket to Work program, which is a unique program in that we administer funds, and where the one-stop center works with individuals who have disabilities and assist them with getting off of supplemental security income and Social Security disability insurance.
Can you say what WIOA means again?
WIOA, that's the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. That's the federal act that a fair amount of our resources come through, and that also established workforce development boards as an entity. Other programs that we funding and programs that we administer, we receive funding through the Research Foundation for Mental Health, which is a state Office of Mental Health arm. We receive funding through the Strategic Tourism Planning Board. And then, just to give you a sense, the Workforce Development Board has responsibility for oversight over the Career Center. Its certification, the Career Center has to be certified through a process, and their compliance with many of the same requirements that we have around funding and program. And also, the board also administers we have career pathway initiatives. Some of our major influences, federal funding requirements, and I will say the state's interpretation of those federal funding requirements, both the law, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, and the regulations. So the state's interpretation is also a major influence on the Workforce Development Board. Lack of state and federal investment in workforce development, I'll say, I think you've all been hearing, both at the state and federal level over the last 6 months, workforce development is so critical. You're hearing it from President Trump's administration, from U.S. Department of Labor, and you're hearing quite a bit from the governor. Funding has not matched the rhetoric. It's really, so just to give you a sense of what occurred earlier in the year, there was a lot of conversation about workforce development at the federal level and the need for it, and then the president's proposed budget zeroed out the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. So, I'm telling you that. I think we all know what the president proposes is not what necessarily happens. But we absolutely have to be continually advocating for federal and state funding to match the rhetoric, because I agree, we've been saying for a long time that this is a huge the need for a skilled workforce and for folks to have the skills to compete is a critical issue at this point. And funding hasn't always matched some of that rhetoric. I'll also say just really quickly that earlier this year with the governor's budget, there was a lot of talk about it. I'm still remaining hopeful and optimistic, but the governor was to hire a workforce czar. That hasn't happened, so zero has been done at this point to plan for how the money that was set aside in the state budget will be utilized. They don't want to do anything until they hire their workforce czar for the state. So that's where we're at right now on that. And then also major influences, all the same things I think you regularly hear: transportation, childcare, and housing. And those challenges are clearly around ensuring that folks have a way to get to work in environments where, and let me say, predominantly for rural work and shift work, where TCAT might work for the first shift and might work for someone who's coming into the city to go to a job at, say, Cornell and out of the city from that job, but it really doesn't allow for shift work and rural to rural job opportunities it continues to be a big challenge. Childcare, the issue around childcare is the quantity, the quality, and the cost, the same things that you've been hearing, and it remains a challenge because we, too, can't place people into opportunities when they can't get to work, when there isn't what they need from a child care perspective. Those are some challenges that we have. I do want to go back for just 1 minute to the budget slide and say that whenever we do county budgets, we are estimating our funding for a full year ahead of time. So the revenue in both the Workforce Development Board budget and almost all of Terry's budget is estimated based upon what we know about our federal and state funding. The federal funding is the one that we remain more concerned about. But we're estimating for fiscal year July 1 of 2019 when we estimate, because our fiscal year for federal funding is July through June. And so I'll also say that we did not find out what our allocations would be for this July 1 until about the beginning of May. So that's sort of the cycle we're dealing with right now. So I say that because I think it's really important for you to know that we monitor constantly what's going on at the federal level. We belong and are very involved in the state, our state professional association, NIATEP, and are very involved in the leadership of that group. And NIATEP and four other state associations employ a lobbyist that is in D.C. all the time, focusing on and lobbying to make sure the funding stays there, and we're able to make what I would say is a moderately educated guess on these funding cycles on these funding estimates. But I always make sure to let you know that if there's areas of my budget and Terry's budget that are concerning, it's always that we have to estimate so far ahead of time with those cycles. So let's see here. So FTEs remain constant. For 2019, our target, our FTEs in 2000, actually this isn't correct, I'm sorry. In 2018, our FTEs were 2.35. In 2019, we're asking that they stay at 2.35. So I'm not sure how that happened and I didn't catch it. My apologies. So between 2018 and 2019, we're not asking for any changes in FTEs. I'm going to let Terry.
All right. I'm losing some of you, I can tell, so we'll try to make this fast. Okay. All right. Excellent. So you want to scroll ahead. All right. Okay. So at Tompkins Workforce New York Career Center, we have a recommended budget of over $1 million, and we take the money in and we spend it accordingly. Most of the money comes from, as Julia said, our federal and state revenues from the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act. That's where the majority of our funding comes from, and we have estimated this so that we're hoping, we've estimated based on getting the same amount of money next year as we received this year, and hopefully that will be the case. It's generally stayed pretty flat. Sometimes we get an increase in one of our funding sources, but it's almost always joint with a decrease somewhere else. So we pretty much stay close to the same amount of funding every year. And you will see that $115,245 is local funding that is reflected in the interfund transfer line, just as Julia's budget shows. We've had some layoffs and plant closings this year, which have really affected the amount of traffic coming through the Career Center. Vanguard and Mettler Toledo were two of the big ones. We've had some other smaller ones as well. And we have provided rapid response for these companies, especially Vanguard recently. We provided services in collaboration with the New York State Department of Labor staff, including a job fair that we pulled together with very short notice, just about 2 weeks. We turned that around, had businesses there right on site for the employees there to meet with potential businesses and We continue to have businesses calling us saying, do you have any of the Vanguard employees to send our way because we want them? So we are being there for those employees and trying to continue making that connection. We're continuing also to provide services to those employees in terms of making assessments to help them return to work as quickly as possible. We're working with them on all kinds of things from, you know, resumes, interviewing skills. Many of the individuals have been at these companies for years, and so interviewing is something very new to them. We are also, as part of the reemployment services, we may, when necessary, put individuals into training or retraining to help them get into jobs that will be family sustaining. And that very often means changing to a different type of career. There is a lot of demand, of course, for employees in Tompkins County and the surrounding areas, as you know. But sometimes they're in fields that are different than the field that someone is being laid off from. So we do retraining services as well for those individuals. Part of this is the types of jobs are changing, so we're trying to flex with that. We have had overall a decrease in the number of individuals walking into the Career Center because of the good economy, but that in actuality allows us to provide more intensive services to the individuals that are coming in because those individuals are generally having a significant number of barriers, and so we're working with the individuals to try to clear those barriers or help them work around whatever the situation demands in order to get them employed. We have some new program initiatives this year. You'll see in our budget that we actually have more money in the budget than last year. That is due to the Disability Employment Initiative that we received, which is federal funding passed through the state to help promote a system of change. So we're serving individuals with disabilities between 14 and 24 years old, and we're also trying to develop a system where the schools, the colleges, and all of the service providers in the area are working better together to provide more rounded services for these individuals and help them get into jobs and careers faster. We know that people with disabilities coming out of school generally have a harder time entering the job market, so we're working through this initiative. We also, you're probably familiar with the arrival to departure training that is going on through the tourism program, and we will be training a couple of our staff people to teach and facilitate that training for Tompkins County. We've also had some staffing changes. We did a little bit of a reorganization this year to assist in, you know, providing better services for the individuals coming into the Career Center. I guess I went over a little bit about what we do at the Career Center, but basic job search assistance, resume writing, interviewing, funding for classroom and on-the-job training. We work with both youth and adults. We have high school equivalency classes right in the Career Center this year, including we're going to be having a daytime high school equivalency class that BOCES will be doing downtown, which is good for all of us. Career advisement, counseling, referrals to other agencies, business connections, and so forth. And the resource room that we have available has computers with internet access, phone, fax, copier, all of those things. So if individuals don't have those services at home, they can come into the Career Center. And this is my big faux pas for the night. I have a JPEG file with a right over somebody's face, but we'll just say that person didn't want to be seen on camera. I'm not quite sure how that happened, but, you know, it'll give you a little humor for the end of the night. So in the Career Center, we have co-located partners. These are mandated partners through the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. It includes, of course, us, the Office of Employment and Training, the Department of Labor, Access VR, which works with people with disabilities, BOCES, and Challenge Workforce Solutions is there as well. And the pictures are part of part of a medical careers initiative that we do every couple of years to try to get high school students interested in medical careers, because that is a high demand occupation in our area, and all of the local medical facilities are desperately in need of more employees. So our full-time equivalent, you'll see there's an increase for this year, and that is due to the Disability Employment Initiative. So we did add a person on to cover that particular grant. So that's the increase that you see. It actually ended up only being a half-time increase, but it is through that grant that it's funded. Our goals for next year: improving the overall skill level of available workforce, increasing youth participation in the labor market, providing better employment connections to the underrepresented individuals in the community, connecting local businesses with available resources and human capital, continuing to strengthen our collaborations with the other agencies and partners in our community, and to continue to provide outstanding customer service to the people who walk in the door. So, thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you both. Anna.
One question I have is actually easier, about the A2D program. I'm wondering how many people you have been trained. The target I know is a lot higher than the on-ground program, so I was curious how it's going.
At this point, we are in the build-out stage, so we have focus groups in August. And the contractors in build-out stage for the website right now. We're expecting to pilot that program in October with full-scale trainings happening for the – so it's online and then an in-person class component, and we have our first non-pilot class component scheduled for November and December. So it just gives you a sense of our timeline, and you will be hearing quite a bit about it over the next couple of weeks. You'll be receiving an invite to be part of pilots, and we're hoping to get many of the legislators to consider taking the training program. It's quick. It's easy, has, as I said, the in-person component, a 1.5 hour in-person class component.
That's great. The other question I had was, I've heard you talk a lot about the mismatch between the skills that our current workforce has and what's needed in the field, businesses, and then, you know, on the previous slide you list the goals that you have. Do you have specific target quantified goals every year that you try to hit, like, and any report outs that you can do? The only reason I ask is because I'd love to get my mind around the extent of the problem that you guys are facing, so that I can plug in my own mind where you're doing your program work and get a sense, because I know you guys do such a wide swath of work. So
I will say that we are part of, in 2018, the county's performance initiative. The Workforce Development Board is. The Career Center is scheduled for next year. So we are part of that initiative. And we're working diligently with Dave, and we'll be meeting with a consultant, I believe it's next week,
But we also have federal standards, performance standards that we have to meet around our entered employment rates, so the number of individuals, how many of the, what percentage of individuals that are served in the Career Center enter employment, what their median wage is in the second and fourth quarter after they exit the program. And then there are additional requirements for youth around skill attainment, credential attainment. And so there are performance measures, and then there are also additional performance measures from the state at times that the state occasionally adds. One of the challenges that we have is a big portion of the measures that we have come from the state's operating system that we share with the rest of the state that is matched with wage and finance data at the state level, so taxation and finance data at the state level. And since the start of WIOA, they've not been able to figure out how to get the data back out of the system to tell us how we're doing against the measures. So we have goals? We do have goals. There are measurements associated with the performance, the performance standards that we have, and we're also working with Dave and Jason around the entire performance accountability system.
Leslie?
Thank you. Thank you very much, ladies, for the late hour and your presentation. The goal of improving overall skill levels of available workforce that goes sort of hand in hand with low unemployment rates and more job openings than candidates with suitable skills. I know I've seen this goal many times before, and I just wonder if you can enlighten me in what you all have been doing to try to reach this goal as newer industries are coming on board.
So we have specific sector strategies, specific strategies in sectors that are targeted, advanced manufacturing, healthcare, and hospitality and tourism, to meet with businesses on a regular basis and also survey businesses around what their needs are. And then, so having an understanding of what are the skill sets that are needed, and then conveying that information to others related to that data. I think that you all know TCAD also has a workforce development position in their work plan for 2019. We'll be working collaboratively with TCAD to do a better job of relaying some of that information. But we also work, both the board and Terry's shop, work very closely with community agencies that are speaking we work very closely with people coming in the One Stop Center, but also very closely with community agencies to let folks know about the opportunities and to connect businesses with different entities and agencies to let them know about those opportunities and about where we expect to see growth in the future.
Thank you very much. Thanks for indulgence for such a long evening with us. And we got so far behind, but your presentations were very enlightening. Thank you.